Good afternoon and welcome to Radio Istina number 22. This would be August 26th, year of Liar Lord 2008. And I'm going to talk to you for a couple of hours about politics and race, black nationalism, even archaeology. I think we'll start out with just a little bit here today. What we started talking about last week was black nationalism and Marcus Garvey. And we're going to conclude that story from Culture Wars, the magazine. And we'll also delve into one of the problems occasioned by the integration that the Jews who set up the NAACP favored. And then, I think to conclude, we will talk about some of the Hussites and some of the interactions in Europe of the Jews and the those who were trying to purify the Catholic Church and eventually split away and form the Protestant Church. And we'll get a Michael Jones's Catholic read on that, as well as have some stuff to say of our own. So first, though, I'd like to talk a little about what I said last week about writing to Simon Shepherd. Now, I've written to him, and I hope many of you have also. And if you go to our viennainforum.com and you go to the Speech Martyr subforum, you can find the address for Simon Shepherd and Mike Whittle, or I'm sorry, Stephen Whittle, who are imprisoned in California in Santa Ana pending their asylum hearing. And they're writers from Britain. We talked about them in number 21 last week. I've written them. I hope you will, too. That's all I'm going to say right now. And I want to talk a little about a archaeological discovery. And this is some of the positive side. A lot of what we do at VNN Forum is criticize Jews. And that necessarily consumes, you know, about 50% of what we do. The other part is trying to provide a sense of the opportunity cost of allowing ourselves to be dominated by Jews. That is the kind of society we could be living in were it not for this hostile parasitic race that has taken over our top institutions. And one of the things that is particularly interesting about white nationalism is that it's open to the physical facts of human and animal existence, whereas these are history is seen by Jews as something that's rewritten to suit current need. And there was a find recently in Germany that's a good example of the type of thing that whites would spend their time doing if they were not living under a Jewish hate machine where the academia is perverted and false schools are set up and non-whites and non-males, women, are legally privileged over whites. They'd spend a lot more of their time doing real research on valuable topics. Like I've said many times, you know, what's the one area of the economy that's been the most remarkable over the last 20, 30 years? Well, it's been computers. And this was a field created out of nothing by white men. And that's what you basically find. As areas of the economy become older, they become dominated by the politicians, and the politicians do what they do, which is they discriminate in favor of Jews and coloreds and women, and they discriminate against white men, even though white men are the ones who get the economy started, whether it's by discovering oils or figuring out how to develop computers. Now, I wanted to just talk a little bit about this as an example of a lot of the stuff that we have at VNN that's not directly related to politics, but is interesting. And recently in Germany, they've not only have they found their own Stonehenge a couple of months ago, they found what's considered to be the oldest record of dinosaur life ever, is the way the writer puts it. 250 million years old. First we'll talk a little about Stonehenge. Archaeologists have discovered traces of a Bronze Age palace of worship in Germany in what they say might be the country's answer to Stonehenge. This is near Halle, H-A-L-L-E, a 4,000-year-old circular site in eastern Germany which contains graves that bear a strong resemblance to Stonehenge, a prehistoric stone circle of towering megaliths in southern Britain, which I'm sure you're familiar with. The way it is built, with many concentrated rings of graves, walls, palisades, and pillars, are very similar to the British monument at Stonehenge, adds Spotsier. The site near the town of Pumalta was discovered through aerial photographs which showed the formation of the graves in a ring with a diameter of about 80 meters. Anyway, that's one discovery that has been made in Germany, and another that I just saw the article about the other day was is titled "Sensational Fossil Illuminates Birth of Dinosaurs." An archaeological dig in central Germany has unearthed fossils which could be the oldest record of dinosaur life ever. The dinosaur find at a quarry near the town of Bernburg, 90 miles southwest of Berlin, appears to date from 250 million years ago. And there's an artist rendering of this dinosaur bird, and I think they claim that birds evolved from dinosaurs. And it says, scientists previously believed that dinosaurs evolved from smaller reptiles around 235 million years ago. So this is, you know, it's astonishing how long the world has been around before man. And, you know, you can barely find human-type creatures around 5 million years ago. Says the new find could radically redraw archaeologists' understanding of the dawn of the Triassic Age and the birth of the dinosaur era. This is a spectacular, unique achievement, said Regional Archaeology Chief Harold Meller, announcing the discovery. He said that the crucial remnants, believed to be fossils of bone fragments, had been secured, but the German authorities called on amateur enthusiasts to stay away from the site for fear of damaging potential further finds. If confirmed, the find would add to a long list of landmark archaeological dinosaur discoveries in Germany, including the Archaeopteryx, which showed a link between dinosaurs and birds. It was discovered in southern Germany in the 19th century, helping to cement the reputation of Darwin's theory of evolution. Anyway, this is in our archaeology section. Now, before we get to the conclusion of the Garvey article, I also wanted to discuss something I just observed on the forum, and I've got rid of more people who are causing problems, and we don't need anyone who doesn't have self-control, so you're free to give your opinion, but keep it under control. Keep the paragraph separated by a blank line. If you sign up, follow the rules in signing up, which most people don't do, even though I've said repeatedly that they will be they'll have their account deleted before you make any posts if you do it. So now, let's see. I think I got the sound levels right now. I've tried to raise it a bit so that it's louder. I know some people were finding it was not loud enough before. Anyway. Now, something I wrote and then someone responded to, which I want to respond to right now. What I wrote was, one problem we face, which has nothing to do with IQ, and this is explaining how the mass of the people think, is emotional identification with authority, deep-seated unwillingness or inability to accept objective evidence regarding authority's real motives or unfitness. Whenever this fear is triggered, shooting the messenger is the result. Too many little people feel that the big people are on their side, and this misidentification is far stronger than reason. Talk 911 with a left-halfer, and eventually you can drag out the truth. If he truly believed government were evil enough to produce 911, he would lose all faith and never be able to vote again. Perhaps one-third to half of whites feel this way. The only thing they are biologically fit to do is follow the leaders, even if the leaders head right off a cliff. Only eugenics can change this disposition, this fear-based following. Or we must take power and change the authority the left-halfers are loyal to. A lot easier to change power than change people. With legitimate authority, the people can work wonders. Without it, they are lost. And Horseman says, if I understand, you're basically saying it's political correctness, which is the unwritten rule that you must be a person whom the Jew likes or you're a bigot. and the Jew wants you to trust in big government and think that it's on your side. That is the PC way to be. On the IQ side of the problem, our government is an incredibly complex and convoluted mess of corruption that exists because the voting base is not intelligent enough to realize it. That's why only men should be allowed to vote. Only they are able to recognize it. That's not necessarily false, but it's not what I was saying. What I'm saying is that the mass of people, and I've written this up in a humorous or thought-provoking way, saying that they have a median line, which is an organ that fish have that allow them to turn as one. You see a school of fish, you know, turning as one to evade a predator. Humans seem to have something of that. I'm saying that biologically, people are hierarchical. I mean, that's why the left is anti-hierarchy, because, you know, they can't handle the biological facts of life any more than the Catholics can. And they're being a deracinated version of Christianity. They prefer socialism, whereas is their form of salvation versus individual salvation. They prefer the collective salvation of social gospel. Go out and save the niggers and save them in part by pretending that the niggers don't really exist. They're just white people who haven't been raised right or haven't been given enough money. Now, so I responded, no, that's not what I'm saying. The problem is deeper than PC. I'm saying the mass of people follows authority because of inbuilt biological limitations that prevent it from doing anything else, like thinking and choosing a different way. PC merely refers to what people are supposed to believe, which is changeable. The deep need to follow the prevailing authority cannot be overcome by most people, and this is not an IQ problem. I've seen people who are PhDs who had the same emotional problem as others who are ditch diggers, in that if you're discussing 911, they simply cannot believe. It's too frightening to them to accept evidence showing that their government is not in fact on their side, but is in fact tricking them and using them. And this is not, as I say, it's not an IQ problem. These people, for emotional reasons, have to believe that the government is on their side, so they will identify with a Bush and the Jew warmongers around him rather than see objectively what's going on, which is that they're simply using the country to further their own agenda. And that's the fact of the matter. PC simply refers to the line that the administration is taking that you're supposed to follow, lest they come after you. And obviously, the PC line is anti-white. Anyway, let's leave those aside and let's go on to talk about the end of Garvey. Now, we discussed last time, again, this is an article from Culture Wars, culturewars.com. It's a magazine put out by an independent Catholic intellectual, E. Michael Jones, who's written a couple of books that we've talked about a good extent. We'll continue to talk about. Magazine comes out about 10 times a year. I think it has a combined July and August issue. This article is from the June 2008 issue. And where am I here? Last time we talked about the three schools of thought among the blacks. And these were the cast down your bucket school of self-help, the school of self-help, the school of integration, and the school of back to Africa or black Zionism. So the Jews favored integration. They wanted to integrate blacks with whites as a way to protect their own interest and to further their own agenda. And so they used the NAACP, which they set up and staffed with octoroons and quadroons, to attack any black or any group that advocated a different school of thought, such as self-help or back to Africa. And we're discussing specifically Marcus Garvey, who is the wannabe black Zionist who's going to lead all these black people back to Africa. And we talked about just the different demographic changes and the intellectual changes in America during this period, essentially 1900 to 1920 period. And we left it off with the Jews haven't been radicalized. After the Jewish money and the Jewish revolutionary scum took over the Soviet Union, they were trying to promulgate communist revolutions around the rest of the world, including in the U.S., as well as in Europe. And we saw that the problem was solved in Germany by the soldiers coming home after the war simply killed the Jewish communists and threw them in the canals. And that's the way you defeat liberalism and Judaism, or Judeo-Bolshevism. You defeat it by killing the carriers. You can't kill an idea, but you can kill the people who are carrying it. And on the racial front in the U.S., Garvey, Jones is saying, decided to stay away from some of this radicalization because the NAACP was pushing some of the Communist Party line as well as the Integration Party line, and this was a misstep on the part of the Jews and the NAACP because the country was still basically dominated by white non-Jews, and they didn't believe in any kind of racial amalgamation, as Harding denounced, and they didn't like communism. And so they were not open to certain types of appeals, as we'll see from his writing. And but what they could do at the same time, that Marcus Garvey has come up from Jamaica, he's founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association, and he's holding meetings that are attracting tens of thousands of people, and so the Jews see him as a threat, and they work to undermine him through their own NAACP. So you've got the NAACP doing battle with the UNIA and spreading rumors and telling lies, which is what Jews always do. Whether it's in Europe or whether it's among the blacks in the U.S. And what we've seen is you've got A. Mitchell Palmer, and this is stuff Mencken used to write about, who's suppressing literature that the rulers of the country don't like and preventing it from going through the mails. Now, we talked about the race riots in 1919. And let's see. We talked about the Black Star Line, and this was the shipping line that Garvey set up. Jones says, in the summer of 1919, Garvey seized on an idea that would give symbolic but concrete form to the racial unity of the world's 400 million Negroes when he incorporated the Black Star Line on July 27, 1919, when a battered Canadian ship known as the Yarmouth, but soon to be rechristened as the SS Frederick Douglass, docked at the 135th Street Pier on September 14th, 5,000 cheering Negroes greeted its arrival as one of the greatest events in the modern history of the Negro race. So, the idea of the Garvey and the black nationalists here was black unity, black economic empowerment, leading to black political power. So we work amongst ourselves, we sell amongst ourselves, we make money and raise it and keep it in our community and use that to buy politicians to protect our interests. This was exactly what Jews themselves did, but as with everything else, Jews have one standard for non-Jews and another standard for themselves. What works for them, they don't want to work for you. So they advise against it for you, they advocate against it for you, and they try to pass laws banning you from doing what is good for your interests. Just as they've made white interest in protecting white interest hate in their literature, it's empowerment when they do it. So now, let's look at the history of what happened from about 1920 on here. Jones says that So you've got Garvey, who comes up from Jamaica and who creates his Universal Negro Improvement Association. He's working in New York. We talked last time about Harlem and how this is where the blacks and Jews first intermingled, and the Jews took the black musical sounds and produced it as sort of an early version of hip-hop to scumify white culture, and how the Jewish communists who were back then, you know, at CCNY and spreading their different Trotskyite and Stalinist ideas, how black intellectuals, the talented tenth of the community, were introduced to these crazy radical ideas in Harlem more than anywhere else. Now let's keep the story going here with turn to what Jones says. He says the real issue is integration. In the wake of the Red Scare of 1919, again, this is the Jews trying to do what they can to further communism in America, as they've done in Russia, which they've taken over right around this time. In the wake of the Red Scare of 1919, Garvey abandoned revolution and became a race man instead. In doing so, he found a formula which would appeal to Negroes in a way that the pale abstractions of the leftists did not. From 1918 until 1920, the number of new Negro migrants which came out to hear Garvey speak at Liberty Hall in Harlem increased dramatically in size. Black racism leading to black ethnic separatism was consistent with the American political system in a way that black revolution was not. You see. Remember, we've got these laws at this point that are guaranteeing separate but equal treatment. And these were only reversed in Brown versus Board of Education, which had no precedent. It was simply a power play by Jews who at that time had enough power in the Supreme Court to be able to twist arms and cite their own social engineers rather than legal precedent as a reason for overturning Brown versus Board. And this is in the 1950s. So you see, this is a degree-by-degree buildup as the Jews are fighting with the Americans to take over America. And the Americans, as still had power in 1924 when they passed the Immigration Restriction Act that limited newcomers to the stock of their people already in the country, so we wouldn't be overwhelmed by people different from the Northwestern Europeans who founded America. Now, I may sneeze here. I've been sick the last 24 hours or so, but try not to. Let's see. Jones says, black racism leading to black ethnic separatism was consistent with the American political system in a way that black revolution was not. It conformed not only to the conventional understanding of Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court decision mandating separate but equal educational facilities, it conformed to the ethnic separatism which was the unwritten law of the neighborhood in big cities throughout the North. It complemented as well the white racism of the newly resurgent Ku Klux Klan and resurgent nationalism in Europe in countries like Italy and Germany. Beyond that, it was completely comprehensible to the new Negro migrants of the cities of the North, who saw ethnic neighborhoods everywhere they turned and saw no reason why they shouldn't espouse the same principles in their communities. So again, these are blacks because the Jews manipulated the U.S. into World War I, and the white men are gone from the factories. They need to bring Negroes up from the South, and this is how a lot of the rim of the Great Lakes got populated with blacks, as they're coming out of the South where they all live and moving to places like Detroit, Chicago, Gary, Indiana. During both World War I and World War II, the first 50 years of the 20th century saw all kinds of black movement from south to north. Garvey would later say that he had no problem dealing with the Klan and, quote, other honest white people. But before long it became clear that Garvey had a major problem with the NAACP because that organization, again, that's the Jew-created, Jew-run NAACP, was not interested in ethnic pluralism which characterized the neighborhoods of cities like New York any more than it had been interested in promoting the economic gradualism of Booker T. Washington, and that would be the self-help school. Jews don't want to teach blacks what's good. What's good for blacks is to develop as best they can given their abilities. But Jews say it's better for us if we teach them to hate white men and to demand special legal privileges against him, and to assert our rights and demand special help in the form of welfare and training and the rest of it. That way we can use the blacks to essentially destroy the white community, destroy its ability to protect itself by defining it out of existence and forcing it to work for tax money that is taken from it and used to grow colonies of these blacks who have been taught to hate whites. And in that way we will protect our Jewish interests. So setting blacks against whites is what the Jews did because it was good for Jews. And that's the essential point that you need to understand out of all of our conversation from this article. Blacks were used by Jews to destroy white communities and ultimately the white nation because it was good for Jews. That's the bottom line. And Jews use the same tools today, not just in the U.S., but in Australia, as we've talked about on earlier shows, and also in Europe. And they don't just use blacks, they use any non-whites. So that somewhere in the forum you can find a billboard from Finland that shows a traditional Finnish... The picture that this multicultural promoting ad is based on would show a blonde Finnish peasant girl, but they replaced the blonde girl with an African nigger. Oh, she's just as much of a Finn as the blonde peasant girl. So this is how the Jews destroy white countries. So they don't want blacks looking to Booker T. Washington cast down your bucket and self-help. They want them looking to integration and demanding their rights and claiming they've been abused and discriminated against by whites. Jews put the chip on the black shoulder. And once they achieved the legal freedoms for blacks that they sought, why, the blacks with the chip on their shoulder were out there raping and murdering whites. And then the Jews completed the trifecta by covering it up so that you don't know any of that is happening. Even the government statistics have to be dug out. And they're printed skewed and falsified and hidden in tables. And you have to pull them out to see what they truly mean. But what they amount to is basically 40,000 white women a year reported are raped by niggers. And tens of thousands of whites have been murdered by niggers since civil rights and the communist revolution was successfully pushed through in the mid-60s. All of this is covered up. It's never presented that way in the media. When they talk about crime, they only talk about crime featuring blacks as victims of crime, disproportionate victims of crime. They don't tell you that blacks are the ones committing that crime, that 90% of the interracial crime out there is committed against whites by blacks. Blacks who've been liberated legally, legally privileged by Jews over whites, and blacks who've been given an excuse and a reason to attack whites. And what do whites have? They have nothing. It's all been thrown away. 1900 white men controlled the country, and the country had no debt, and it wasn't forever going around instigating foreign wars. Today, we're bankrupt, and all we do is start foreign wars. Domestically, we have higher tax rates than ever, and the money is used to grow the most dangerous and useless sections of the community. The only solution for whites is to separate from Jews and blacks. We don't need them. They damage us. They destroy us. We don't need them. They need us. Those who think that, oh, religion is the answer. I'm going to do what Jones calls undermining the faith, undermining the Catholic faith right now, because I'm going to suggest to you that the sacraments are not efficacious. That by dripping water in the head of a Jew or a black, you don't turn it into a human. It doesn't work. And white men have recognized that for hundreds of years, and Jones says that's undermining faith. Well, the simple fact is, we're not. If observing simple facts is undermining faith, then the faith has no reason to exist. Faith in that which is false faith. One should have faith that the world can be observed and understood. That's where the faith is properly used. And what observation and understanding tell you is that races are irreconcilable. And dumping water in the head of them will not make them get along, just because Jibu or some of his fans say it will. So, if Jones is scared of the evidence, we needn't be. We'll get to more on that later. We'll talk about that later when we get to the Hussites and a couple more Jewish apostates who converted to Christianity and warned the church about what the Jews were up to. Now, so the NAACP is attacking Booker T. Washington on the one side, on the self-help side, and they're attacking Marcus Garvey on the nationalist side, the black Zionist side, the back to Africa side. The NAACP, the Jewish organization, was interested in integration, especially in the South, because they understood that integration would mean the end of the South as an independent culture. And you know what? Just that phrase was used in the most recent Newsweek. The title story was "The End of the South." This is something liberals have sought for hundreds of years. Why do they dislike the South? Because the South maintained a hierarchical, non-egalitarian, anti-liberal culture of honor rather than degraded, demoralized materialism, as the Jews prefer and feel safest in it. An animal always strives to make its surroundings as comfortable to it as it can. And that's why the Jews always work to undermine white nations. They don't like nations that are stable, coherent, and racially homogenous. They like a mix of mystery meat out there. Just as a rat prefers bags of garbage that can scamper around between and under. White men prefer orderly societies because they aren't rats like the Jews. And so you must always understand the Jewish root of the problems that we face. As Harold Cruz later pointed out, Jews were interested in the integration of every ethnic group but their own. Right? They build walls around Israel. They don't have affirmative action there for Arabs and help, special help for Arabs and bring in black Jews and whatever. No, they discriminate against non-Jews. Jews were interested in the integration of every ethnic group but their own, and in the Negro, people like Lewis Marshall, now on the board of the NAACP and still smarting from his defeat at the hands of Southerners like Tom Watson, had found the vehicle for that subversion. And Marshall's the Jew who's head of the American Jewish Committee, and his defeat was trying to get the Leo Frank case heard by the Supreme Court, which rejected their appeal. And Leo Frank was the Jew pedophile who raped and murdered Mary Fagan down in Georgia, and the Jews tried to buy his liberty. They tried to buy off the politicians, but the people of Georgia lynched the guilty Jew rather than let him get away with, as Jews get away with stuff today when they have more power than they had 100 years ago. Heimreich says that Garvey, who first articulated the cause of black nationalism and separatism, so he's a leader of that school, brought down the Black Jewish Alliance, but the opposite was the case, says Jones. The Black Jewish Alliance brought down Marcus Garvey. Again, this is history you're not going to be taught in school. You might hear a mention or two of Marcus Garvey, but you won't be told the background, which is that his school might have worked, as Booker T. Washington's school might have worked, had it not been undermined by the Jews. The Jews don't care about what's good for blacks. The Jews care about what's good for Jews. What's good for Jews is setting race against race, class against class, sex against sex, and nation against nation. Jews are the common enemy of all mankind, as the Romans said 2,000 years ago. As long as you understand that, you can hardly go wrong. The Jews are your enemy, white man. That's all you need to understand. You are white, they are Jews, they are your enemy. And that's the way to look at politics. Look for the Jew in it. Look for the Jew pursuing Jewish interest against your own. Don't be fooled by conservatism, liberalism, or party name. That doesn't mean anything. Friedman accuses Garvey of, quote, a robust anti-Semitism, and goes on to claim that the emergence of Marcus Garvey was a decidedly ominous development for black-Jewish relations, but that was largely because of the way the Jews had defined the terms of the alliance, which was based on an irrevocable commitment to integration, no matter what the ultimate consequences for the Negro were. Garvey incurred the wrath of the Jew-controlled NAACP because he had the temerity to propose the same program for blacks which Jews were proposing for Jews. Friedman notes the similarities between the Zionism of Herzl and the Black Zionism of Garvey, but fails to note the irony implicit in the fact that Jews ended up persecuting Garvey because he was too Jewish. According to Friedman, Garvey seemed preoccupied with Jews and Judaism. His call for an African exodus bore a striking similarity to the ideas of Jewish thinkers like Pinsker and Herzl. In 1920, Garvey told a UNIA meeting, Universal Negro Improvement Association meeting, "A new spirit, a new courage has come to us simultaneously as it has come to other peoples of the world. It came to us at the same time as it came to the Jew. When the Jew said, 'We shall have Palestine,' the same sentiments came to us when we said, 'We shall have Africa.'" Jones says, Friedman gets closer to the truth when he writes that Garvey quarreled frequently with the NAACP, and more often than not, his grievances concerned the leadership role of Jews in what he believed should have been an all-black organization. The issue is not only the leadership of roles of Jews at the NAACP, the issue is integration, which Garvey saw as debilitating for any group which saw that as its highest aspiration. So Garvey's a proud black saying, look, we can do it on our own. We don't need whites. We don't need Jews. We can do it on our own. Let's do it, black people. That's the successful and healthy outlook. So naturally the Jews wanted to destroy it, to undermine it. White racism, says Jones, was the best thing that could happen to America's blacks, according to Garvey, because it created racial solidarity, which was the foundation of economic solidarity, which was the basis of political power. Kind of like in Scarface. First you get the power, you know, first you get the money, then you get the power, then you get the women. You get the racial solidarity, then you get the economic solidarity, the money, and then you get, with the money, you get the political power. Garvey could see that Jews understood this fact, which is why he urged Negroes to imitate Jews. What he could not tolerate was the double standard implicit in organizations like the NAACP, which promoted integration for every group but the one which controlled the organization. So what's good for Jews is bad for you, say the Jews. What we use to get and keep power, we don't want you using. We don't want you having any power but that which we give you, and that's power directed at specific agenda items. We want you to have the power to blame whites, to have legal privilege over whites, to be able to live among them so that you can mess up their communities, thereby protecting us. Remember, at this time in the U.S., Jews were excluded from the better hotels and the better schools, to a good example, because people knew that they were basically undignified criminal gangsters. Unfortunately, the people didn't pursue the knowledge of the Jew to the ultimate end of, this is what we need to do to protect ourselves from the Jew. That's the only thing whites need to worry about when it comes to Jews. What do we have to do to protect ourselves from these people? They aren't good people. They don't help us. They destroy our society. And they write about it quite openly in their own media. We need to protect ourselves. Just as whites cannot save blacks, the only thing we can do for Jews and blacks is protect our own kind from them. That's the reason for this radio show. Before long, the feelings were mutual and the battle was joined as the NAACP, using Dubois as its agent, set out to destroy Garvey and his movement. So the Jews are going to try to destroy Marcus Garvey and his movement, just as they try to destroy white organizations today. The federal government had already turned against Garvey. The NAACP may have urged the overthrow of state governments in the South, but it was docile to federal power, as evidenced by its pro-war stance. So here's the thing. The Jews hate decentralized government. They want centralized government with themselves controlling the center. That way they can dictate to all the little towns out there and all the small states out there. They can dictate every last little policy. That's what they want. And that's pretty much the way it is today. So the Jews are very active against the state governments in the South who are trying to protect white people, because remember, in a lot of those states down in the Deep South, almost half the population is black. So the humans have to dominate things in order to protect themselves. Otherwise, they'll be overrun, much in the way South Africa has been overrun since ceding political power to the black majority. There's been tens of thousands of rapes and murders of white people since whites relinquished powers at the behest of their own traitorous leadership, which had given in to the international Jewry. And it's ceaseless browbeating through the global media controlled by Jews. So you have to understand the stakes here are the life of our people, and nothing less than that, in this battle that we are in with the Jews. The NAACP, again, to repeat this, the NAACP may have urged the overthrow of state governments in the South, but it was docile to federal power, as evidenced by its pro-war stance. Both Spingarn and Dubois. Spingarn is one of the, Joel Spingarn is a Jew associated with the early stages of the NAACP. Remember, the Jews set this up to use for their own agenda. Both Spingarn and Dubois coveted commissions as officers. Two of the 25,000 Negroes listening to Garvey's speech on August 3, 1920 were FBI agents. That agency had been alerted to Garvey as a threat after the General Counsel of the United Fruit Company had written to the Secretary of State warning him that Garvey's activities, quote, might repeat the French experience in Haiti, which was basically the slaves took over and killed off all the white people and turned the richest colony in the Americas into the poorest under Toussaint Louverture, 100 years before Garvey's holding these meetings. Fearing the same thing, Britain's Foreign Office had already banned distribution of copies of Garvey's newspaper, The Negro World, throughout British Africa after the opening of UNIA branches in Cape Town and Johannesburg. Garvey wrote to Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes disavowing any subversive intent, but the white power structure remained suspicious. In November 1920, Dubois, who had been working behind the scenes to undermine Garvey's movement, and Dubois is the black face in used as a front man at the NAACP. In November 1920, Dubois, who had been working behind the scenes to undermine Garvey's movement, made a significant tactical blunder when he advocated interracial marriage and race mixing as the solution to America's racial unrest. Right? So, back then, that was their first attempt to advocate the policies they advocate all over the place today. And that's why in all the advertising and content that you see coming from TV and from the mass media, they show blonde girls with niggers. Because this is their ultimate solution to the threat that organized whites pose to organized Jews, which is that we will breed you out of existence. We want integration so that you mix with the niggers and you disappear as a threat to us, and we run things on our own, and we dictate to the rest of the world. The white race is our only competitor. So all of this has been underway for 100 years. Now, in 1920, the whites were still solid enough. As I said, I refer to the 1924 Act. Whites were still solid enough and still had enough faith in themselves that there were howls of protest, as E. Michael Jones says, that they would reject. They weren't afraid to publicly oppose the NAACP and the Jews behind it. They weren't afraid to kill the Jews who were trying to murder their communities. Unlike today, when they've been docilized and they've been tamed, essentially. So they don't dare stand up to the Jews. They seem too powerful. That's what we're here to re-stimulate, is we need to control things ourselves. What if normal whites ran things? Whites created America. Jews just bankrupted it. They put their shitty Zelensky parts in our beautiful Callahan box. They keep the flag, they keep the Constitution as external forms, but the internal contents, the reality, have been changed. So that only that which they approve is allowed legally. And it appears they're near to having their ultimate triumph if they can get an actual nigger elected president and then impose their speech laws that forbid any criticism of blacks or Jews. Then we'll be just like the rest of the world. So, in 1920... the Jew-controlled, Jew-backed, Jew-created NAACP pushes miscegenation, pushes interracial mixing and marriage. Howls of protest emanated from representatives of the entire political spectrum, and Garvey's howls were among the loudest. As a result, Dubois and his colored aristocracy, otherwise known as the Talented Tenth, began to sense that they were losing their influence over the mind of the Negro masses. When President Warren Harding gave a speech in Birmingham, Alabama, and announced, "Racial amalgamation there cannot be," he was greeted with cheers, and some of the loudest cheers came from Marcus Garvey, who attacked Dubois as guilty of having committed racial treason. So Garvey's a good guy. He doesn't necessarily want to attack whites. He wants what's good for blacks, and that means separation from whites. He's saying we can go it on our own stick. We can go back to Africa and make a success of it. We don't need the white man. We like the honest white men of the Klan and the honest presidents to stand up and say we don't want white race mixing. And the U.S. president was against race mixing as late as 1920. In fact, even later than that. So know your history. As some indication that Dubois's espousal of race mixing was more than just an isolated gaffe on Dubois's part, Lewis cites a conversation years later between Walter White and Joel Spingarn, Jew. I don't know if White was a Jew, but Spingarn was a Jew, in which White admitted to Spingarn that, quote, unmixed, unquote, Negroes like Garvey and the people drawn to his cause were, quote, inferior, infinitely inferior now, Spingarn quoted him as saying, whatever they might possibly become in the future. Garvey had been exiled to England by the time this exchange took place in 1934, but not surprisingly, Spingarn claimed this is very confidential because it lent credence to Garvey's claim that he was the victim of a quadroon/octoroon conspiracy. So Garvey was well aware that the Jews and the quadroons they employed and the octoroons they employed and featured as their frontman, were working to undermine him and the cause of black separatism. By the end of 1921, Garvey had successfully established himself as a viable alternative to Randolph's black socialism, McKay's black communism, and the integrationism promoted by the NAACP, whose talented tenth seemed to have slipped into irrelevance once the black masses showed themselves willing to mobilize under Garvey's banner of black nationalism. It was then that Garvey's troubles began in earnest. So again we see the Jew-operated feds, the Jew-influenced feds, the Jew-funded feds, are used to undermine any group that looks like it might be gaining power. As long as that group is not pushing the Jew agenda, it's under threat. That's what you need to understand. So like I used the example last time of Chester Doles raising dozens of people in his meetings about what was going on vis-a-vis immigration. And that was in Georgia. And the Jews use the feds to go after him. And they invent or find technicalities to go after any leader pushing an agenda that runs counter to theirs. That's what you need to understand. The Jews are organized and they are our enemy. And they are wrecking our nation. And wrecking nations is what they have done for 2,000 years. It's what they are. It's not a behavioral choice. It's what they are. It's far deeper than that. E. Michael Jones can't handle that truth, but you listening to this should be able to handle that truth. Sprinkling drops of water on the head of a Jew no more changes it into a white human being than sprinkling water on the head of a Chihuahua turns it into a German Shepherd. That's the truth. After the 1920 rally, Garvey had reached the peak of his power. Things went downhill after that, largely because of problems with the Black Star line. That's his shipping line. The shipping venture had turned into a money-gobbling disaster, largely because Garvey had bought broken-down ships at exorbitant prices. In late October 1919, after a rousing send-off given by 6,000 members of the Unia who assembled at Harlem's 135th Street Pier, a battered hulk now rechristened as the SS Frederick Douglass set sail for Cuba with $4.8 million of whiskey on board to avoid confiscation when the Volstead Act went into effect on January 20th, 1920. Remember, this is so Prohibition's about to set in. The battered Douglass made it as far as the 23rd Street in Midtown Manhattan when it had to turn back because it lacked the proper insurance. Setting sail once again, the Douglass was plagued by mechanical problems associated with its antiquated boilers. Because it had not been loaded properly and was listing dangerously, the Douglass had to throw much of the cargo overboard off the coast of New Jersey, where it was picked up by smugglers in boats, lending credence to the belief that the crew was involved in what was a theft of the cargo. By the time the Douglass limped into Havana Harbor on March 3rd, most of the whiskey was gone, having been either stolen or drunk by the crew, exposing Garvey, who had signed a full liability shipping contract, to an enormous loss. After three equally disastrous voyages, the rusty Frederick Douglass, which had cost the Black Star Line a total of $194,803 in 2 years of operation, was sold for $2,000. So, in order to settle a judgment of $1,625, so blacks proved incompetent at running their business, even apart from Jewish hostility and attacks. The financial record of the other Black Star Line ships was equally disastrous. The Shadyside, an excursion boat that the BSL hoped to use to ferry Harlemites up the Hudson during the oppressive months of the New York summer, swallowed another $31,000 of Black Star money before it ran aground and was abandoned. In less than a year and a half, the Kanawha took in $1,207 of income after swallowing another $134,681 of Black Star money. So obviously they're completely financially incompetent. By the end of 1920, Dubois, the NAACP, knew enough about the Black Star Line's financial woes to publicize them in the crisis and eventually use them to bring about Garvey's downfall. In December 1920, Dubois published an article in the Black Star Line in the crisis that asked why the Black Star Line had been accepting deposits on tickets to Africa on a ship which they did not own. Desperate to get a ship that could reach Africa, the Black Star Line had fallen in with a dubious broker by the name of Anthony Rudolph Silverstone a.k.a. Silverstone, who had promptly appropriated $10,000 of Black Star money intended to be a deposit on the ship. Silverstone, according to Lewis, later sought to claim this $10,000 as his personal property, despite the fact that the Black Star line was repeatedly dunned, that is, billed, for payment of the Wiley broker's promissory note. Was there any wonder that Garvey belatedly began to suspect treachery in the Black Star camp? By bringing up the issue of the deposit on the tickets, Dubois broached the issue of fraud in public for the first time. Garvey had fallen in with Silverstone because he needed the Phyllis Wheatley for his plan to relocate Black to Liberia. Now, Phyllis Wheatley was a Black poetess at the times of the American Revolution. And if you've taken English classes in a public school, you probably come across some of her poems. Since she's Black, they're obviously going to promote her. There is no indication that he did not intend to use the Phyllis Wheatley for this purpose, which would mean that, as well, that his intent was not to defraud. Garvey's failure to carry out his scheme for resettlement could be laid sooner and more logically at the feet of his own business ineptitude, or the machinations of Silverstone, or Dubois's machinations with the president of Liberia. So, as usual, the Jews are working all the different angles to see that the Black Star line fails, and to promote its failure, and to promote their own countercause of integration. Before long, the government and the NAACP began acting in concert, just as the government today acts in concert with the SPLC in setting up a terrorist cell at Elohim City and blowing up a government building and blaming it on angry white men and white racists and haters. So the NAACP, the Jew-created organization, and the government are working in concert. During April of 1921, Dubois was working behind the scenes to thwart Garvey's Liberian construction and resettlement scheme, communicating frequently with Liberia's President King during this period. President King, at Dubois's urging, made his antipathy to Garvey and his schemes clear in his communications with the State Department in Washington. So you get that the Jew-created NAACP is working to undermine Garvey's scheme to resettle Blacks in America back in Africa. In its June 1921 issue, the Crisis published a statement by President King announcing that under no circumstances will Liberia allow her territory to be made a center of aggression or conspiracy against other sovereign states. That's President King of Liberia. In August 1921, William J. Burns, the director of the FBI, wrote to the New York Shipping Board and asked them not to sell the Black Star line the ship which Silverstone, who had already taken $22,500 for the sale, had promised. So the FBI is interfering with Garvey's business as he tries to acquire a ship to be used for the resettlement of American blacks back in Africa, which would solve many of the problems that we have with blacks. All of them, actually. The Jews didn't want that. They want those blacks here in America to destroy your community. And they're using their power to influence the government, even back in the 1920s, to undermine the Back to Africa movement. The Shipping Board, which claimed that Garvey's Unia was the Communist Party, which is affiliated with the Russian government, and that Garvey himself was a radical agitator who advocates and teaches the overthrow of the United States government by force and violence, then took 6 months to issue its sale contract, and when it did, demanded a performance bond that amounted to twice the purchase price of the ship. The delay in the purchase of the ship lent credence to Dubois's claims that the BSL was collecting deposits for tickets on a ship it did not own, but the fact that the BSL was unable to obtain ownership was due largely to the machinations of Silverstone and the Shipping Board. There was no fraudulent intent on the part of the Black Star line. Now, Jones doesn't say whether or not this Silverstone was actually a Jew, but one might reasonably think that. As if Garvey didn't have enough troubles, competing Negro organizations like the dubious Friends of Negro Freedom began organizing Marcus Garvey Must Go protest, claiming, among other things, that Garvey was a monkey chaser. an American Negro term of opprobrium used to refer to blacks from the Caribbean and Africa, that UNIA stood for Ugliest Negroes in America. Playing his own version of the race card, Dubois denounced Garvey as a West Indian agitator. In a letter to the State Department in Washington, which also solicited damaging information which Dubois could publish in the crisis. Garvey didn't help his case any by aligning himself with white racists like Senator Theodore Bilbo of Mississippi and praising groups like the Ku Klux Klan. Between the Ku Klux Klan and the Moorfield Stories National Association for the Advancement of Certain People, give me the Klan for their honesty of purpose toward the Negro. Garvey made statements like this, according to Lewis, because he was fed up with the integrationist hypocrisy, especially the sort promoted by the NAACP. So, this is Garvey speaking. He says, between the Ku Klux Klan and the Moorfield Story National Association for the Advancement of Certain People, give me the Klan for their honesty of purpose toward the Negro. When Marcus Garvey was arrested for mail fraud in January 1922, he was generous in assigning the blame for his troubles to a long list of persecutors. Before the indictments, Garvey had used the pages of the Negro World to claim that Bolshevist agents had been paid to attack the Black Star Line. Equally guilty was the white shipping industry, which had devoted a $1 million campaign to boycott and pull the Black Star Line out of existence. By January 1922, he was claiming that certain Negro advancement associations had paid men to dismantle our machinery and otherwise damage it so as to bring about the downfall of the movement. When a year passed without a trial, a group of Negroes wrote an open letter on January 12, 1923, to U.S. Attorney General Harry M. Doherty, demanding that Garvey be brought to justice. The letter demanded that the Attorney General use his full influence completely to disband and extirpate this vicious movement, and that he vigorously and speedily push the government's case against Marcus Garvey for using the mails to defraud. The fact that a number of the Negroes had ties to the NAACP only deepened Garvey's suspicions. So again, the Jews are putting these blacks up to writing letters to the Attorney General to get Garvey busted for something he didn't do. Once Garvey cited the NAACP as one of the conspirators determined to bring him down, it was only a matter of time before he would bring the Jews into the same picture. Garvey's suspicion that he was the victim of an NAACP Jewish-inspired conspiracy was strengthened when he learned that the presiding judge at his trial was Julian Mack, in Friedman's words, quote, a member of the German Jewish aristocracy who also served in the board of the NAACP. So as we've talked about, Jews dominate the law schools and they have their own people in position to render judgments on any who would oppose them. Whether it was blacks in 1920 or whites today in 2008. When Garvey's motion to have Judge Mack dismissed for conflict of interest was denied, he became even more convinced that he was the victim of a, quote, international frame-up, unquote, declaring, quote, I am being punished for the crime of the Jew Silverstone. So it was a Jew, an agent for the line. I was prosecuted by Maxwell Maddock, another Jew, and I am to be sentenced by Judge Julian Mack, the eminent Jewish jurist. Truly, I may say, I was going to Jericho and fell among thieves. Garvey's trial finally began on May 18, 1923. Having failed to unseat Judge Mack, the Jew, in spite of the fact that he admitted having contributed to the NAACP, and thus he should have recused himself for a conflict of interest, Garvey proceeded to fire his own lawyer and went to represent himself, proving right the old adage about the man representing himself having a fool for a client. Garvey proved his inexperience in the law and courtroom procedure by automatically objecting to every motion of the prosecution, an action which dragged out the trial and antagonized the jury, which returned a guilty verdict 4 weeks after the trial began. Any doubts which Garvey might have entertained about Mack's bias in the case must have disappeared at the sentencing. Garvey was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison, the maximum sentence, even though there was nothing to indicate that the BSL had been formed for anything other than what it purported to be, a Negro improvement venture. Clearly, the collapse of the corporation could be attributed chiefly to poor judgment in the purchase and maintenance of the decrepit Black Star fleet, and here the real criminals were white culprits who had unloaded rusty hulks on unsuspecting and inexperienced Negroes. So they paid a hell of a lot of money for a bunch of crappy old ships that these whites were eager to unload on them, and not only did their BSL venture not work, the Jews conspired to have Garvey thrown into jail for fraud, when in fact it was not fraud, but simple incompetence that led to the failure of the Black Star Line. Lewis calls Judge Mack, the Jew, a model of judicial patience and wise impartiality. But the fact that Mack, also in Lewis's words, was, quote, second only to Louis Brandeis in the American Zionist movement, unquote, and, quote, widely reputed to be both a co-founder and active member of the NAACP, unquote, causes no suspicion of bias to rise in his mind, even though Lewis finds that the verdict was somewhat strange and that the other three Black Star defendants were acquitted of any complicity in the crime. This is indeed a strange outcome for a conspiracy trial. So basically, this was a political trial, much like Matt Hale or any other white leader that the Jews want to destroy. There's nothing logical or reasonable about the outcome. It's merely a decision guaranteed in advance to advance Jewish interests by destroying the leading figure of the Back to Africa school. In spite of the fact that, quote, the feeling began to grow among Negroes that Marcus Garvey was the hapless victim of white justice, and this tended to enhance his prestige both in the U.S. and abroad, unquote, and in spite of the Jewish NAACP connection, which the judge himself did not deny, Lewis claims that, quote, Garvey's conviction was a self-inflicted tragedy, and goes on to accuse Garvey of anti-Semitism because, quote, behind Mack's NAACP membership and presidency of the American Jewish Congress, Garvey divined sinister, clandestine forces bent upon destroying Black people's best hope of advancement. From this curious moment onward into the late 20th century, Black Zionism would carry a distinct malodor of ideological anti-Semitism. So, this is what the Jews always do. They undermine someone and then blame him. Oh, he caused his own problem. Oh, his anti-Semitism is destroying him, even though it's their own conspiracy that brought him down. Again, the Jews will continue to use the same tactics until they don't work. The tactic that we can use to beat the Jews is to kill them. It works. Exterminating Jews is the solution to the Jewish takeover of our society. In spite of his conviction and the concerted attack against him, Marcus Garvey's movement was stronger than ever when he spoke in Madison Square Garden on the night of March 16, 1924. The 1924 UNIA convention had, if anything, even more pomp and pageantry than the 1920 convention, something which caused W.E.B. Du Bois more than a little annoyance, since it seemed that Garvey was on, quote, the verge of successes that would confound his detractors. So here the Jews have been working to undermine this guy for 5 years. They've got him convicted. They've set up a conspiracy to screw with him through the federal government in every which possible way, and to write magazines against him, to denounce him to the FBI and get the FBI and the Attorney General to go after him for fraud where there was no fraud. Despite all this, he's still doing well in 1924 and has a huge convention. Du Bois attacked the conference publicly by calling Garvey the most dangerous enemy of the Negro race in America and in the world. He was either, quote, either a lunatic or a traitor, unquote. The fact that Garvey unveiled his Liberian resettlement plan at the 1924 convention allowed Du Bois to continue to work behind the scenes with the U.S. State Department as well. So the Jews are working with the FBI, they're working with the Attorney General, they're working with the State Department, and they're working with the King of Liberia to ensure that Garvey is never able to get any large number of blacks to go back to Africa. So, those of you out there who are conservatives who listen to this, and you think your silly little girlish twitterings about how we need to dress or behave differently, and that's what's keeping people from accepting what we say, that's what's keeping our cause from advancing, you are serving the Jew. First of all, you've never done any of this yourself. So you aren't aware of the true force out there. It seems easy to you, writing under an anonymous name, making a comment on an internet board, to point out where everyone's going wrong. You and your kibitzer role. But in fact, when you see, it's not just whites, it's blacks who have suffered the same things from Jews conspiring to defeat their honest attempt to lead their people to liberation. And just as it was with blacks and Marcus Garvey yesterday, it is with whites today. And that needs to be understood, assimilated, gulped, swallowed, and thoroughly integrated into your mind by you kibitzing conservative cowards. And of course, the conservatives are encouraged in this misunderstanding by the winos, the whites in name only, the Jew ousters. And the Jew apologist, like the Amren, sites which exist solely to protect the Jew and not to advance the whites. Well, Jews are doing the same thing today with white nationalism that they did with black nationalism yesterday. They're attempting to undermine legitimate white nationalism by convicting its leaders, such as Doles or Matt Hale, of things of which they're not guilty, and by misrepresenting their aims of the movement and the leaders to the wider population. And the Jews are in a much more powerful position today than they were yesterday, because they've had 100 years of learning how to learning the byways of power in America. The fact that Garvey unveiled his Liberian resettlement plan at the 1924 convention allowed Dubois to continue to work behind the scenes with the U.S. Department of State. Cronin portrays Garvey's claim that the machinations of W.E.B. Du Bois led to the collapse of the Liberian Project as paranoid fantasy. He blamed his old enemy, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, this is a quote, who was visiting Liberia at the time, at the same time as the American representative to the presidential inauguration, for the collapse of the venture, charging that Du Bois had sabotaged the work of the Garvey Association in order to further his own Pan-African movement. And there's a few typos, actually, in this paragraph. Garvey later characterized Dubois' statement as purely and simply a white man's nigger. And instead of white man, he should have said Jews nigger, because Dubois served the Jews. And as Jones says, but Dubois was in fact conspiring to destroy Garvey's plan. On July 10, 1924, Consul General Ernest Lyons wrote from Baltimore to inform Dubois that no person or persons leaving the United States under the auspices of the Garvey movement in the United States will be allowed to land in the Republic of Liberia. 2 weeks after the date of Lyons' letter, a UNIA advance party arrived in Monrovia, that's the capital of Liberia, named after James Monroe, and was immediately placed under arrest and deported on a German ship. When the Daily Worker printed Robert Miner's suspicions about Dubois' collusion with Liberia against Garvey, Dubois lied about his involvement, calling the story in the Daily Worker, quote, an unmitigated lie. So even as the Jews and their quadroon frontmen are conspiring against Marcus Garvey, they are denying it. They're lying. They lie to cover up their conspiracy, just as we see in 9-1-1. The government continued its harassment as well. In a move that seemed designed to thwart the 1924 UNIA meeting, a grand jury indicted Garvey for perjury and income tax evasion shortly after the convention began. As some sign that Garvey's racial appeals were having success among Negroes, a group which called itself the Negro Sanhedrin, made up of 300 black delegates from 63 organizations, met in Chicago in 1924. The Negro Sanhedrin, and Sanhedrin is a Jew word for the gathering of rabbis to set policy and agenda for the Jews. The Negro Sanhedrin was based on the Paris Sanhedrin of 1807, which Napoleon convoked to get the Jews on his side so that he could invade Russia. The Negro Sanhedrin in 1924 was inspired by Garvey and its proceedings as set down in, quote, The Negro Speaks for Himself, unquote, edited by Elaine Locke, were a clear rebuke of the Jewish paternalism promoted by the NAACP. In spite of the clearly Jewish inspiration for this meeting, the Jews ignored it, admitting tacitly, according to Cruz, that the, quote, fight for the civil rights of blacks was ultimately a long-range civil rights defense of the status of Jews in American society. That is, the Jews who set up the NAACP didn't give a whit about black interests. They were about protecting Jewish interests and advancing the Jewish agenda. The Jews remained adamant in their refusal to support the Negro whenever he proposed a program that was too close to the program of ethnic and economic solidarity promoted by the American Jewish Committee and other like-minded organizations. On February 2, 1925, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals rejected Garvey's appeal of his mail fraud conviction, and 6 days later, Garvey arrived at the federal penitentiary in Atlanta to begin serving his sentence. Reacting to the growing sense that Garvey had been railroaded, President Calvin Coolidge granted Garvey a pardon in late 1927. But since Garvey was not an American citizen, he was from Jamaica, and had been convicted of a felony, he was immediately deported as an undesirable alien. After a triumphal progress through the Caribbean, which not even the State Department harassment could deter, Garvey made his way back to Jamaica and eventually to England, where he died all but forgotten in 1940. Once he was safely out of the way, the crisis, in an editorial which appeared in 1928, declared, "We have today no enmity against Marcus Garvey. However, their enmity against Garvey's fundamental issue of life, namely the appeal of race to race, the appeal of clan to clan, the appeal of tribe to tribe, would continue unabated in organizations like the NAACP, even though Zionism would continue to make the same appeal to Jews." And that's where he concludes his article. And he has full footnotes of all the different sources that he cited in this. And again, the lesson here is that Jews attempt to deny others the same routes they themselves take to power. In order to keep their power as the leading power, they must suppress, indoctrinate, brainwash, and discriminate against everybody else on earth, even where they claim to speak in their name. So the Jews use their power to destroy the white nation by integrating it with these black savages. And when the talented tenth that would lead the black community tries to do something genuinely in its interest, like taking its people back to Africa, the Jews intervene and set the guy up and send him to prison. So the white movement need not reform its actions and behavior and dress so much as it needs to undermine the Jews who are preventing it from developing. Because our case is the case of the American people. They support everything that we do. They are against affirmative action. They're against foreign wars. And they're against endless subsidies of Israel. Yet they have no voice speaking for them in public. Because the Jews have shot down all their leaders as haters or set them up on bogus charges and had them imprisoned. So what the Jews do to whites today, we've learned from this lesson they were doing to black nationalists yesterday. The lesson, as always, is not that Jews are people to be talked to or dealt with in any way. They're people to be exterminated. That's the mistake that white society has made over the last 2,000 years, is treating Jews as something despicable and disgusting rather than something to be exterminated. Jews may have been discriminated against. They may have been kicked out of different nations and towns. But the proper way to deal with the Jews is simply to get rid of them so that they never cause a problem, and that means extermination. Exterminated Jews can't undermine and wreck white nations. That's the takeaway here. Now, let's take a short break, and then we'll come back and we will talk about an article on VNN about a white father shooting an obstreperous nigger at a party thrown by his kids or his daughter. And let's see, we're going to take a two-song break here, and then we'll be right back.
From my past, I was so happy, but joy in this life seldom lasts. Mm-hmm. birth. He helped me warn the ships at sea. We have grown closer, till his joy meant everything to me. And he was to marry a girl who shone with beauty and light. And they loved each other, and with me watched the sunsets into night. And the winds crashing around me, and the sand slips down to sea. And the winds that blow remind me of what has been. Found her washed up on the shore. He kissed her cold face, that they'd be together soon, he swore. I saw him crying, watched as he buried her in the sand. And then he climbed my tower, and off the edge of me he
Okay, the second song I was going to play isn't working, so we're going to go right to the story, and this will not be a particularly long segment. After it, we will go into E. Michael Jones's book and talk about the Hussites, or the Hussites, a remarkable group of people in Central Europe, given the CI-like views of themselves, and somewhat some craziness. Anyway, the story I want to discuss now is about a white father who shot a couple of monkeys in South Carolina. And let me see here. I'll up my levels a little bit here. Illusion with beauty and light. Alright, let's see here. I think that should be loud. Probably should be about loud enough. Here it is. Now, this is a recent story from South Carolina. South Carolina father accused of killing teenager at party. And this is this is your standard AP story, so you know it's going to be biased. A South Carolina man shot an unarmed teenager to death after a scuffle at a weekend party thrown by his children, then shot two teens involved in a retaliatory shooting at his home, authorities said Tuesday. Francis Marion Reeves III, 62, is charged with murder in the Friday shooting death of 17-year-old Deshaun Rashad Clark and was released on a $125,000 bond after a Tuesday court hearing. The shooting is still under investigation, but prosecutors and authorities described a chaotic scene at a small party hosted by Reeves' children at the family's lake house in Lexington County, just west of Columbia. Reeves' children claimed a cell phone was stolen. Someone accused Clark of taking it, and he scuffled with another person and was struck several times before leaving and threatening to return with friends, police said. Reeves' son went to the family's other nearby home to get his father, who brought a loaded pistol and unloaded shotgun over to the lake house. The father was told that his daughter had been attacked at the party and watched as his son was attacked by three people. After Clark returned with friends, Reeves shot him, prosecutors said. Partygoers scattered and the friends took the injured teen to a fire station. He died at the hospital. He literally bled to death, prosecutor Rick Hubbard said. Reeves' attorney, Dick Harputlian, said his client acted in self-defense, fearing that he and his children were in danger. This is a tragedy. Anytime somebody dies, anytime somebody's killed, that's a tragedy, but one has a right to act in self-defense, Harputlian said. Reeves returned to his home afterward and was sitting on the front porch when one of the slain teen's friends drove by and shot at his home in retaliation. Reeves fired back with a shotgun, police said, striking two teens who were in the car. They were not seriously injured. One of the slain teen's friends has been charged with assault with intent to kill in the drive-by shooting. Breon Jacoby Myers, 17, remained in jail Tuesday after his bail was set at $100,000. When deputies arrested Reeves on Saturday, he appeared intoxicated, authorities said. He was traumatized and upset about what had happened and had been up all night long, and he had several drinks, Harputlian said. Reeves did not speak about the shooting during the hearing Tuesday, but nodded to family members as he left the courtroom. Around two dozen family members of the slain teen also attended. Family members described Clark as a soft-spoken and sensitive teen who planned to play sports at Chapin High School this year. Family members and some residents of the community have speculated that race was a factor in the shooting. The dead teen is black and Reeves and his children are white, but authorities say race was not a factor. Clark's uncle, Corinthia Stack, 49, said he feared that Reeves' release could cause more violence in a town just 22 miles from the state's capital. "We don't want it to inflame more violence," Stack said. Now, this is exactly the sort of garbage that Jews sought by undermining the Back to Africa movement to create in America as a way of empowering themselves. And they, through their media and through their court system that they control, through their domination of law school, are able to define what happens in all of these cases so that they encourage whites to mix with blacks, and then when the inevitable happens, they blame the whites. Whites are the only ones who can take any kind of responsibility for anything, so they get the burden of this system that the illegal invader from Mexico and the descendant of slaves doesn't have to bear any burden whatsoever. So blacks are free to come to white parties where they're encouraged to think that white girls like them and attack the white people, and if the whites bother to defend themselves, they soon find themselves in jail, in court, and abused in the papers by the Jew media. This is the cost of allowing Jews to control our nation. And you can bet that nothing good is going to come from this for Francis Marion Reeves. And this is from August 19th, 2008. I want to see if there's been any... And, you know, typically you've got the niggers out there issuing death threats, and of course nothing happens to them. But when whites make any kind of a threat at all, we had another story this week from California where some black guy and a white guy are using CBs in their trucks to get into it, and the white guy gets thrown in prison for several years for making threats. But when blacks make threats, less happens to blacks from carrying out threats than happens to whites for making threats. And this is the price of allowing Jews to take over our country. Here's another story. This is more recent. In the wake of a fatal shooting Friday night at a Chapin High School student, extra law enforcement officers will be at the school when students return this morning. There had been some concerns that were raised in the community about talk about some type of disruption at the school. So one of the things the principal wanted to do was obviously avoid that, said Buddy Price, Lexington Richland 5 spokesman. And so they're charging this white man with murder for protecting his kids from these niggers. And the lesson here is never, ever allow any kind of nigger at your home or function. The thing is, even if you know one of the talented 10th or one of the few blacks who's any good, that black is going to have all kinds of friends and relatives who are just average niggers who aren't any good. And that's the crucial thing to understand. And if you're, you know, and this goes not just for good whites, but for bad whites. If you're selling drugs or whatever, you sell some drugs to a nigger, the nigger knows that you have drugs at your house, what do you think is going to happen? The nigger's friends are going to show up and rob you. Because niggers talk to one another. And they're open to different ways of stealing and thieving and getting ahead because they don't have what it takes to work and get ahead like whites do. They don't have the brains for it or the character for it. So any piece of information you turn over to a black, you know, it's just like the verbal equivalent of like an STD. You know how they say, well, you're sleeping with everybody that person has ever slept with. Well, it's the same way by word of mouth. When you tell a nigger something, that nigger is going to tell that to all of his friends, and that may well end up being used against you. Because certainly within the circle of every nigger out there are loads of bad people. And you don't know when that's going to come home to haunt you. So the proper way to deal with niggers is to segregate them from yourself. Keep them away from you. Don't ever rent a house to a nigger. Don't ever sell a house to a nigger. Keep niggers as far away from you and your kind as you possibly can. And yeah, they have laws against that, but there's no way that they can prove that that's what you're doing if you don't write it down. So never sell, rent to, or hire a nigger if you can possibly avoid it. And 99% of the time you can. All you have to do is make sure that they can't prove legally that that's what you're doing. Because they can create problems for you if they can prove that. And what we see in this instance, when whites protect themselves, they immediately become shit on by the white power structure, which is eager to curry favor with the real powers that be, the Jews and the Jew-empowered niggers. So they're more than willing to throw you to the wolves. And something like this, you know, you have a party, oh, there's a couple niggers there, what's the big deal? Well, niggers are thieves and liars. So the nigger steals something, he gets accused of it, he starts acting like a nigger. Instead of taking blame, he runs away and comes back with his friends, and it leads to a situation where the father has to shoot him to protect his kids. Next thing you know, the father's in jail. Even if the father doesn't end up in jail for a few years, which he probably will, you can bet his legal bills are going to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. He's drawn into the system. The niggers bring the heat down on everybody because they're inherently a criminal race by comparison to whites. They can't meet white standards. They're not white people. The standards that you, average white out there listening to this, think are universal are not universal. They're white standards. Coloreds, muds, and Jews can't meet them because they're not white. There's a racial basis to the desirable life that whites want to lead. And whites, taken one with another, have more or less the same general idea of what constitutes the good life. Well, we can't live the good life with Jews and blacks around. And this kind of story is found over and over and over. And really, I don't think there's a heck of a lot more to say about it right now. Yeah, see, accused killer released on $125,000 bond. The media will always play it up. The media is hostile to whites. It's controlled by Jews. It's always going to play up this dangerous, evil white man angle. And that's what you see. And don't think that all that stuff, because it's fictional, doesn't have an effect. When all the crime shows show whites molesting kids or white serial killers or evil white racist redneck hicks who live out in the sticks, that has its effect on people. The media is more real than reality to most people because they can't think and they're animal. We talked about it earlier. They go along with authority, and TV is authority to most people.
They haven't evolved enough away from the animal and into the human to choose their own way. As Pierce used to say, only a percentage or two of people are inherently intellectually capable of deciphering the bullshit and picking the right way out of the different choices presented by TV. And you're not going to get any good choices from TV. You're going to be portrayed on TV as serial molester, as child molester, as serial killer, as wimpy, weak husband, or as passive spectator of athletic Negroes. And those are the only choices that TV has to offer the white male. Or homosexual, I should add that. So that's five bad choices. And you're going to be shown as fitting one of those profiles. That's how they portray you. Jews hate whites. That's why they portrayed blonde males as evil in their movies, and blonde females as stupid sluts in their movies and on their TV. They are hostile to every other race. They hate us. Jews hate whites. That's the part they don't tell you. They don't teach you that in school, because it's true. If they taught you that, you'd understand what was going on and do something about it. That's why this show exists. And, you know, of course, a part of that is not only portraying the white man as bad, but, oh, this nigger, oh, he was shy, soft-spoken. Yeah, sure, he was an innocent nigger. Every nigger who gets murdered was always a wonderful person who had all these aspirations, all these great things this nigger was going to do in life, rather than the reality. Well, this nigger was a phone thief, a drug user, and a bum. And if he hadn't been shot doing this, he would have been off committing some other crime and wound up in prison that way. That's what most niggers are like. So the meta story here is that you can't allow a hostile people to control your media and your means of communications. And yet that's exactly the situation we have in the U.S. today. Let's see one other source here and see if there's any... There's been nothing written about this for basically the last... Today's the 26th. There's been nothing written in the last week. The last reports are from the 20th. And here we have a report from the state, South Carolina's homepage. It advertises itself as, I'm not sure where the state comes from, but an article by Ishmael Tate. Yeah, they have pictures of some of the relatives of the nigger. They show the white man in the orange suit, handcuffed. And, you know, this just utterly illustrates the danger of allowing your family to mix with niggers. You cannot allow it. They will drag you down in this way or the other, whether it's into using drugs or whether it's getting into fights and going to prison. Who knows? If niggers were capable of more than being niggers, they would have demonstrated at some point in the last 5 million years. But they have not. So when they return, now listen to this. So the nigger basically gets in a fight over a stolen cell phone. The whites are saying that the nigger stole the cell phone. A fight breaks out and the nigger gets his ass kicked. The nigger then comes back. And see, listen, this is how niggers operate. When they returned to the lake house on Lexington Lane, Clark had come back with 3 carloads of people. 3 people attacked Reeves' son, but according to witness statements, Reeves shot not at the people attacking his son, but at Clark, who was standing nearby. The teen scattered at the sound of gunfire. I think I shot someone in the leg, Reeves told his children. So he killed the Clark. A friend of Clark, Breon Jacoby Myers, remains in jail. So interesting. So this, he may have brought, I guess that's why the authorities say there wasn't race involved, but one of the people that the nigger brought back, one of the people, the 3 carloads of people, was named Breon Jacoby Myers. Now, I don't know, maybe that was a nigger, maybe not. It doesn't say, but this is simply what happens when you get involved with niggers, and you don't want niggers at your party. You don't want niggers anywhere alcohol's involved. You don't want them at any function related to you. You don't want them on your property. All they're going to do on your property is break stuff or see stuff worth stealing at a later date. And anyway, that's the story from South Carolina. and we'll track that and see how that works out. But the lesson to the rest of us is don't get involved with niggers in any possible way. Segregate them. Keep them away from you and your family. And now I want to turn to, and this will wrap up the show. I'll probably go at most maybe an hour here longer. And perhaps not that long, but there's a lot of good stuff. And I was reading this last night preparing for this about wacky people in the Catholic Church and the battles in Europe as Protestantism begins to take shape and the Enlightenment begins to take shape and their Jewish converts and apologists, and they're kind of working with these different radicals within the church. And I'm giving you kind of the Catholic view of it, which is that anyone who breaks away from the Catholic Church is a bad guy and usually aided or even led by Jews. That's kind of the E. Michael Jones view of these people. But the bottom line here in the real debate is over whether Jews can truly convert and whether they exist as biological creatures or they're just unconverted Catholics. And the answer to that is obvious, and it was even obvious. Even Jones admits in here that, you know, basically it's most of these Catholics don't believe that the... They're undermining their own faith by doubting the efficacy of sacraments, such as baptism. Whereas a good Catholic, like E. Michael Jones, believes what Jesus says. Jesus says if you drip water on a Jew, it becomes a Christian. Or I don't know if Jesus says that, but the Jew, Saul, who became Paul, said it. So Jones believes it, and that settles it, as far as he's concerned. But in fact, it does not settle it. And so what we'll talk about today are a little from chapters 4 to 7 of The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History by E. Michael Jones. Yes, the same one of the Marcus Garvey article in Culture Wars. So this is his book, which he produces along with his magazine. He's written a good number of books. Let's see. Check how we're doing here. Okay, looks like our sound levels are pretty good. Now, he says, we had talked last time about Jews in Spain and how they were seen as subverters and a fifth column and how that is correct. And now we're going to talk about the Hussites and some of the insanity, really interesting stuff that went on in Bohemia, of all places. And Jones kind of sees this as one of the first revolutions in Europe. And this is, you know, this is in the 1400s. This is preceding the French Revolution at the end of the 1700s and the English Revolution in the 1600s. And this is even before, this is in the 100 years before the development of the printing press. And I'm just going to read some of this. He says, trouble had been brewing. This is chapter 5, page 149. Chapter 5, the revolution arrives in Europe. Trouble had been brewing in Prague for years. Ordained a priest in 1400. 1 year later, John Huss, or Hus, became dean of philosophy faculty at the Charles University, founded in 1348. At the pinnacle of Prague's golden age, to honor St. Charles the Great. And we want to talk a little about some of the radicalism here. And basically the idea here is that people are breaking away from the Catholic Church. They want a purified, a back to basics. And there have been so many movements in Christianity that have attempted to do that. And what a lot of them have ended up doing is embracing the insanity and counterproductive behavior advocated by Jews as a way to undermine white society, so that you find that these breakaway Protestants and these or these insane monks or whatever, these mini movements, the leaders of them work with the Jews because they have the same agenda in mind, to undermine and subvert the faith in the people. At least that's the Catholic traditionalist point of view, is that if people would just stick to the, if the Catholic Church is the only setter of social policy and the promoter of culture, and if people just stick to that, everything will be fine. That's their position. And it might be true that if they would do that, they'd be better off than some of these Protestant crazies. But ultimately, we see that what the Catholic Church says, if it's not founded in the truth itself, is also destructive. And that's what we see when it comes to race. And there's a good deal of disagreement. A lot of these Christians, these breakaway, we're seeing the same thing I am, which is that a Jew convert remains a Jew, no matter if he's taken the sacrament of baptism or not. And there's an inherent suspicion that, baptism doesn't change the nature of the thing baptized in the way that the Christian church claims, which is the truth. But it's not a truth that Jones will admit. Now, he says Huss or Hoos, and I'm not sure of the right way to pronounce that, but it's Bohemian in any case, so we'll say Hoos. Hoos, like Wycliffe, appealed first to the example of the primitive church. That appeal soon went beyond the primitive church of the New Testament to a more appropriate object of imitation in the Old. Joshua leading his people in battle against flesh and blood foes, not against the principalities and powers the church fought. Hus's appropriation of Wycliffe's conflation of regnum and ecclesia encouraged others to revolt. He quotes, "Rome became the Antichrist, and Hus's followers long for that blessed hour when the whore of revelations will be stripped bare and her flesh consumed by the fire of tribulation," as Nicholas of Dresden, one of Hus's followers, put it. The appeal to Judaizing primitivism expressed a general and comprehensive rejection of the Roman system, a kind of total alienation from the status quo. In statements like that of Nicholas of Dresden, we breathe the atmosphere of revolution with evangelical love, humility, and suffering displaced by the fanatical hatred that so often forms their psychological correlate. We breathe, in other words, the toxic vapors of the revolutionary movement, which Jones's whole book is about. And the basic idea here is that just like Christian identity people, they want to be the real Israelites. Well, that's been a recurrent deal throughout the Christian church. There have just been pretty much all the time there's at least an undercurrent of people who feel that way and create some crazy movement to bring it into being, which to us atheist racialist, it seems simply insane. I mean, you can live by the means of the Greek moderation and not live crazily and yet not be subject to Catholic claims about Jesus and race, claims that are false. Men don't come back from the dead, and dripping water in people does not change their fundamental nature. We talked about that earlier when we said, most people have to follow, just biologically, they are not capable of accepting that authority is completely, utterly, and totally corrupt and opposed to their interest. They are always ultimately going to side with authority and kill the messenger, because they just haven't evolved past that point. And people may have a capacity to make choices about their actions, but there's only a window there in which they can make choices. A lot of things that they do are not preordained, but they're set by the limitations of the beast in humans every bit as much as in animals. And it's the church's position that men are different in kind from animals, but facts and observation tell you otherwise, that they are very much like animals. So the racialist view is distinct from the Catholic view, and the Catholic view is wrong. Hus's idea that Bohemia was a holy nation led the Czechs inexorably into conflict with other ethnic groups, particularly the Germans, who constituted a significant minority in Prague and the northern and western sections of the kingdom. The conflict first surfaced at the university, where it took on philosophical trappings. Since most Germans were Occamite nominalists, the Czechs gravitated via Wycliffe into the realist camp. Hus's German colleagues at the university orchestrated a condemnation of Wycliffe's teachings in 1403. Undeterred, Hus continued to promote Wycliffe and in 1408 his priestly faculties were suspended, proving himself a master of academic politics, who orchestrated a successful counterattack, persuading the king to disenfranchise the German nations at the university. After Hus's coup, more than 1,000 Germans decamped for Leipzig, where they started their own university in 1409. The University of Prague lost the esteem of the academic community throughout Europe, but it became a more effective instrument for Wycliffeite propaganda, which became more revolutionary under Hus's guidance. Rome and Prague were on a collision course. So, this is kind of like early Protestantism, in that they're saying that Rome is corrupt. We need to get back to the simple, basic truth that the first Christians knew, and we need to act the way they do, and anything that gets in the way of what we want, we're going to destroy physically. And this is common to the revolutionary mindset of unwillingness to take any direction or to exhibit any self-control, and instead get caught up in the sew of one's own rhetoric and let it lead one to violent acts. Gets anyone who gets in the way of doing what we say is right. Very similar to the sanctimonious madman Elijah Lovejoy. And, you know, set the what did they call it, the immediatist, you know, set those niggers free right now. That's the only moral thing to do, and not caring in the whit about the effects. Well, there's similarity in these people when they've lost control of their minds and they're fighting authority. On the basis of their insane visions. And, you know, we see in the Hussites or the Hussites direct parallel to the left behind crazies today. And Jones says, by now it should be clear that Hus could not have led a congregation of Catholics into rebellion against the Church of Rome without invoking the Old Testament. Hus and his followers had already described the Czechs as, quote, a holy nation. Unlike the New Israel, warned by Jesus that those who lived by the sword would die by it, the Bohemian zealots, who conflated regnum and ecclesia, could spread the gospel with the sword because Bohemia was their ecclesia and their religion derived from the messianic politics which revolutionaries from the time of Simon Bar Kokhba, the Jew who fought against the Romans, had gleaned from the Old Testament. Since there was only one holy nation, Bohemians came the New Israel by default, so just like the Christian Identitarians. The concept holy nation is a conflation of the secular regnum, that would be the rule of a king or the king's area, with the spiritual ecclesia or the church is a Jewish idea. Again, the concept of holy nation is a conflation of the secular regnum with the spiritual ecclesia is a Jewish idea. The Hussite revolution was, at its core, a rejection of the Roman church and its adherence to Christ's claim that his kingdom was not of this world. They're saying his kingdom is of this world, and we're going to bring it into power through a gift of the bloody sword. The popes would term the idea that a holy nation wielding the sword could create heaven on earth a return to the vomit of Judaism, and that's a figure that Jones uses a lot, which comes from the church fathers. This was the essence of revolution then, and revolutionaries from Bar Kokhba to Trotsky have remained faithful to this creed. Many Jewish commentators have noticed the underlying congruity between Talmudic Judaism and revolution, calling Hus a Czech priest who had loosened the bonds in which the church had ensnared the minds of men. Heinrich Gretz notes, the flames fired a multitude in Bohemia who entered on a life and death struggle with Catholicism. Whenever a party in Christendom opposes itself to the ruling church, it assumes a tinge of the Old Testament, not to say Jewish spirit. The Hussites regarded Catholicism not unjustly as heathenism and themselves as Israelites, which must wage a holy war against Philistines, Moabites, and Ammonites. Church and monasteries were to them sanctuaries of a dissolute idolatry, temples to Baal and Moloch, and groves of Ashtaroth to be consumed with fire and sword. Again, a lot of what Jones is doing in this 1,100-page book is quoting the most famous Jewish historians like this Heinrich Gratz, and correcting them. and showing you how dishonest and Jewy they are. And illustrating what he takes to be what's wrong with Protestantism and here and there racialism by showing how much it runs in line with the Judaism. Now, millennialism played an increasingly prominent role in the revolutionary mind. Millennialism was a derivation of two biblical texts, Daniel 7, describing the fourth beast or kingdom in Daniel's dream, and Revelation 20, describing the reign of 1,000 years. And there follows a long quotation from Daniel. The fourth beast is to be a fourth kingdom on earth, different from all other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth, trample it underfoot, and crush it. As for the 10 horns, from this kingdom will rise 10 kings, and another after them, and this one will be different from the previous one, and will bring down 3 kings. He is going to speak words against the Most High, and harass the saints of the Most High. He will consider changing seasons and the law, and the saints will put into his power for a time, 2.5 times. But a court will be held, and the power will be stripped from him, consumed and utterly destroyed, and sovereignty and kingship, and the splendors of all the kingdoms under heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His sovereignty is an eternal sovereignty, and every empire will serve and obey him. Historically, Daniel is referring to Alexander the Great as the fourth beast. His kingdom split after his death into 2 main divisions, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, but its reign is only temporary. His kingdom will be succeeded by a kingdom which has an eternal sovereignty. Revelation 20 complements Daniel's vision by describing the 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth that begins when an angel came down from heaven with a key of the abyss in his hand and an enormous chain. The angel then overpowered the dragon, that primeval serpent which the devil and Satan chained him up for 1,000 years, which is the devil and Satan, and chained him up for 1,000 years. He threw him into the abyss and shut the entrance and sealed it over him to make sure that he would not deceive the nations again until the 1,000 years had passed. At the end of that time, he must be released, but only for a short while. When St. John wrote his Apocalypse, the fourth beast was associated with Rome, specifically with the persecutions of Nero, which took a terrible toll on the nascent Christian church. So this end times crap from today was alive in 1400s in Bohemia. And of course, the same idiots are out there, trying to make the parallel between, or the analogy from all the people they don't like are represented by the bad people in Revelation, and they represent the holy people. And so these people are engaged in disputing Revelation, which is the job of idiots, but they're no less dangerous for being idiots. Now, I want to read a little here about what Jones says about monasticism, and this is the basis of their claim that Catholics are civilized and carried on the best of the pagans from Greece and Rome, and they preserved this in a sea of barbarians from the north. And this is a conceit that Thomas Fleming also exhibits. And, I mean, we know the truth archaeologically and from patterns that the people of the north were not barbarians like these clowns are saying. We know that, in fact, much of whatever was good in the church came from the German tribes and not from the Catholics. But what Jones says is, if there were one institution associated with this 1,000-year reign in Europe, it was the monastery. And he's talking about, the Middle Ages, the time from maybe 400 to 1500, when you had, the Enlightenment, which is their bête noire, the thing they hate. Nothing symbolized the Roman religion better than the monasteries. This is page 155. The monastery, which antedated the rule of St. Benedict, its most enduring norm, encouraged men to live like angels on earth by proposing a way to live the gospel, to live the counsels of perfection Christ proposed to the rich young man in the gospel. When the rich young man asked Jesus what he must do, quote, to possess eternal life, unquote, Jesus tells him to, quote, keep the commandments, unquote. When the young man replies by saying that I have kept all these, what more do I need to do? Jesus tells him, if you wish to be perfect, go and sell what you own and give the money to the poor, and you will then have treasure in heaven, and then come and follow me. Jesus' boldness shows the radically supernatural character of the new covenant, which the fathers of the church stressed. The commandments are natural. The counsels of perfection are supernatural. They transcend a man's natural inclinations, sex, food, money, autonomy, which the commandments regulate by confining within the bounds of reason. You must not kill, you must not commit adultery, you must not bring false witness, honor your father and mother, and you must love your neighbor as yourself. The new way involves a radical departure from the natural order. Sell everything you have, give the money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, then come follow me. Thus the monastic vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, all flowing from the absence of money. Those who did not marry did not need money to support their families, nor did they need the autonomy necessary to use that money wisely as heads of households. They could live like angels on earth. Monasticism preserved the culture of antiquity when the predations of the barbarian tribes threatened to destroy civilization after the collapse of the empire in the 5th century. That is the sacking of Rome, etc. And someone writes me and they say, Klassen called the Book of Revelation a Jewish nightmare in Technicolor. And by the way, it's Revelation. It's not plural. It's Revelation. Look it up. And I would agree with that. I think Hunter Thompson said something that it had starbursts of great writing, but it's, you know, the person who wrote it is basically insane. Anyway, we'll let the Catholics make their case here. So Jones says, monasticism preserved the culture of antiquity when the predations of the barbarian tribes threatened to destroy civilization after the collapse of the empire in the 5th century. The rule of St. Benedict enabled the establishment of stable autonomous communities and a cultural lingua franca, the Christianization of classical culture, that would be Greece and Rome, that prevented Europe from disintegrating into a patchwork of warring ethnicities. Monasticism did this according to the letter of the gospel, not by the sword, but by gentle example. Like the mustard seed that became the tree in which the birds of the air found shelter, the monasteries gathered in the marauding barbarian tribes and civilized them. Like the yeast that inexorably but imperceptibly suffused a lump of dough to raise it, the monasteries raised the level of European culture by integrating Christianity, classical culture, and local ethnic identity into one powerful whole. The Benedictine monks who sailed down the Danube from the Regensburg brought the gospel and culture in its most practical and mundane forms. A Roman senator sent to administer the border provinces along the Danube said it was the unhappiest place on earth because its inhabitants had neither grapes nor olives. The Benedictines brought grapes, transforming the wilderness into a garden, a vineyard, and an orchard, all still standing today, bearing fruit over 100-fold over the 1,000-year reign of Benedict in Europe. The monasteries became wealthy in the mundane sense by ignoring wealth. The individual monks renounced money, but their labors produced enormous wealth for the monasteries. That wealth grew over generations because the monks did not have children or the expenses they require. More importantly, their lands were not constantly divided as children inherited the land from their fathers. The monks who had turned their backs on wealth ended up living lives of wealth, and wealth led to moral decay. The enemies of the gospel used that moral decay to justify their attack on the supernatural way of life, deeply repugnant to the carnal mind. Christ told his followers that those who live according to the gospel will elicit hatred from the carnal. The monasteries were no exception. Jesus would always symbolize those wise in the ways of the world, but blind to the higher realities. Jews would always symbolize the wise in the ways of the world, but blind to higher realities. Those who loathed the order the church imposed on Europe allied themselves with Jews to vent their fury on those who lived according to laws that transcended nature. A wealthy church will soon attract those with no taste for the counsels of perfection, even if they have to take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience to gain access to that wealth. Wealth can promote its own decline. Carnal clerics feel resentment and oftentimes manifest the very resentment their own immoral behavior has fostered in others. Again, carnal clerics fuel resentment and oftentimes manifest the very resentment their own immoral behavior has fostered in others. John Zalewski, the apostate monk, would be a good example of just that sort of behavior. Cohn, who I presume is a Jew historian, claims that the resentment arising from poverty created the Hussite Revolution. Heyman disagrees. He says that largely because of laws designed to attract German settlers, the lot of the Bohemian peasant was significantly better than in the rest of Europe. At no time again until the early 19th century were Bohemia's peasants as relatively well off as in the period preceding the Hussite Wars. This is in the 1400s, so the peasants are doing fine, then you have Huss upsetting them. Slavery, the engine that drove wages down, had disappeared in Bohemia in the course of the 12th century. Haman contends the church owned 50% of the land in Bohemia and as such had an insurmountable advantage over peasants and the princes, who gradually united in resentment of monastic renunciation and the prosperity and moral laxity it engendered. The peasants, a revolutionary class, at Tabor, were unhappy because the wages the monks received, no matter what they did or did not do, were consistently higher than what the peasants and the proletariat could demand. Once the peasantry caught the millennial virus, no economic calculus was applicable because what was then at stake was not better wages, but heaven on earth. And this is the thing, these religious crazies are going to bring about heaven on earth by means of the sword. And that's sort of a communist way of looking at it. Or a false Christian way of looking at it. To the carnal and uneducated peasant, the destruction of the monasteries took on a numinous quality. Destruction of the monasteries, perhaps more than any theory about communion under both species, united the revolutionary movement. So these peasants are angry at the monks living better than they do, and they want to sack their monasteries and steal their wealth and drink their booze. This strain of messianic politics made the Hussite Revolution different from the great English peasant revolt of 1381 or the Pasteurux uprising in France in 1320. The Hussite Revolution is inexplicable as a purely socio-economic development. They, said one Hussite referring to Rome, have introduced as necessary for the kingdom of God, Greek rules, Aristotelic justice, Platonic sanctity, and Gentile rights and honor. The Hussites would have none of this. Like Muslims before them and the Puritans after them, they were willing to burn down whatever edifice contained more than their understanding of the Word of God. To bring about the kingdom of God, then, the holy nation of the Bohemian warriors had to destroy the monasteries. Once that repository of secularized Christianity, or the Mulier Fornicaria, which the Bohemians identified with Rome, had been destroyed, heaven on earth would rise phoenix-like from the ashes of the burned monasteries. So they're going to bring about heaven on earth by means of the sword and sacking the Christian monasteries. And they have their own view of the Bible and what's right, and they're getting back to early Christianity, and they're dispensing with all these monks and monasteries that they don't like. And again, this is in Bohemia, and this is in the 1400s. And I'm just reading, you know, there are elements, and we're in them now, where I am not learned, and I don't know enough to dispute what this historian E. Michael Jones is saying. And in this instance, I prefer to read and make whatever comments I can. I know, obviously, when we get farther in this book to the 20th century, I know much more about that period, and I can more easily speak to where Jones is wrong or misleading people in this part. I have to trust what he said. I simply haven't read enough to dispute a lot of it. But even so, we can see clearly where his Catholic orientation comes in. And that's the part I've mocked repeatedly, as thinking that baptism, the sacrament of baptism, can turn a Jew into a human being. Or a nigger into a human being. And the racialist view is, no, it can't. And he brings this out because a lot of the people in the church didn't believe it could either. But anyway, I think this is simply interesting material. And there's a lot of it. I could read 30, 40 pages, and maybe I'll do that. But we'll see how we feel. My voice holds out. We'll keep going. He says, while Huss was encouraging his congregation to take up the sword, one Bohemian was doing just that, but not in Bohemia. In July 1410, John Ziska, Z-I-Z-K-A, John Ziska of Trocnov, T-R-O-C-N-O-V, fought in the Battle of Grunwald, G-R-U-E-N-W-A-L-D, that would be Green Forest, at which the Polish nobility decisively defeated the territorial ambitions of the Teutonic Knights in Prussia. Of the 50 divisions constituting the Polish army at Grunwald, 2 were composed entirely of Czechs, and 3 in part. Zizka, an impoverished squire who was blind in one eye, spent his younger years organizing hunts for the king. He also engaged in brigandage, plundering the estates of the local magnate, Lord Oldrich Rosenberg, a man Zizka would plague his entire life. At the Battle of Grunwald, Zizka witnessed medieval warfare in all its panoply, but left the field unimpressed. Since the invention of the stirrup, the major offensive weapon in armed combat had been the cavalry. Zizka realized that the aristocratic army of armored knights on horseback could be neutralized by judicious use of terrain. Armed horsemen were unbeatable on an open plain, but they were not as effective charging uphill, especially if the defenders surrounded themselves with trenches and portable fortifications and made judicious use of the newly developed firearms, especially at close range. The Golden Lane at Radkani Castle in Prague, and I'm probably butchering the pronunciation, H-R-A-D-C-A-N-Y, Castle in Prague, had traditionally been home to the king's alchemists, and one of their tasks was developing firearms and potent gunpowder. That tradition has continued to this day with the production of Semtex, developed in Czechoslovakia during the communist era and the preferred explosive of terrorists during the 1970s. So these traditions in Central Europe are going on for 600-800 years. Zizka would use a Czech expertise in explosives in unprecedented ways, changing the face of warfare. And that's one of the corollaries here, or the side stories, is these religious kooks who are doing battle with Rome are, in one or two instances, military geniuses who are developing new tactics and strategies for defeating the larger surrounding community who doesn't like them or their game. When Zizka returned to Bohemia in 1411, he bought a house in Prague, intending to settle there as one of the king's retainers. One of his duties was to accompany Queen Sophie to chapel, since the queen was attending Bethlehem Chapel. Zizka imbibed Hus's messianic Bohemian nationalism ex fontem. I guess that means from the source itself. So Zizka, who is this fighter, is hearing what Hus has to say. He also ran head-on into Hus's conflict with the Pope and the local bishop, which was reaching its climax when Zizka returned from the Prussian Wars. On June 12, 1411, Archbishop Zbynek, placed all of Prague under interdict, which meant that none of the sacraments could be confected there. King Wenceslas, I presume the one in the song, Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen, told Praguers to ignore the bishop, fostering Hus's agenda of creating a national church. If the king could lift an interdict, then his power exceeded that of the bishop and even that of the pope. In meddling in spiritual affairs, Wenceslas may have been influenced by the Wycliffeite, that's English John Wycliffe, Wycliffeite doctrine of the supremacy of lords temporal in matters spiritual. State over the church, that is, which had been preached at the Bethlehem Chapel. Vindicated by the king's defiance, Hus continued to preach sermons derived from Wycliffe, and the masses who attended Bethlehem Chapel edged closer to revolution. Wenceslas, though, was motivated by something less lofty than philosophical principles. In 1412, Pope John the 23rd, called for a crusade against King Ladislaus of Naples. To finance this campaign, the Pope authorized the sale of indulgences. And you remember that's what pissed off Luther, was the sale of indulgences, among other things. When papal representatives arrived in Prague to sell indulgences, the king did an abrupt volte face, about face, and sided with the Pope because he stood to benefit financially from indulgences sold in his realm. Hus denounced the sale of indulgences. The papal legate sold whole deaconries, towns, and cities to unworthy clerks living in concubinage and to other unsavory characters who then, quote, taxed the population as much as they wished. So Hus is battling, like Luther would later, against the sale of indulgences. The Pope then confirmed Hus's excommunication and the interdict on Prague. The Pope also denounced Bethlehem Chapel as a nest of heretics and demanded that it be torn down, which the Pope's supporters attempted while Huss was inside preaching. So, as we would see in Illinois in the 1830s and 40s, the people back in Bohemia in 1400s were more than willing to battle these things out themselves. Since the king had sided with the Pope on indulgences, he could not contravene this interdict, and a stalemate existed until Huss resolved the impasse by leaving Prague. On 15 October 1412, unwilling to deprive the citizen of divine services and access to sacraments, John Huss left Prague and went into voluntary exile. For almost 2 years, Huss lived in the castle of Kozihradek, Kozihradek, and worked in the countryside of Bohemia, writing books and preaching whenever and wherever he could. In exile, Huss continued his agitation against the church, preaching open-air sermons to peasants, whose gatherings foreshadowed the mass Taborite rallies after his death. The propaganda campaign in Prague continued in his absence under the direction of Jerome of Prague. The Manifesto of 1412, a part of that propaganda campaign, again appealed to the sword and the patriarchs of the Old Testament as a summons to revolutionary battle against the Roman Catholic Church, now identified by Jakubek of Strebro and others as the Antichrist. So, Huss leaves Prague, and he's preaching out in the countryside out of a castle. But others continue his fight within Prague, and the Roman Catholic Church is identified by Jakubek of Strebro, not Freshbro, but Strebro, and others as the Antichrist. So the Roman Catholic Church is Babylon, you know, as the Protestants might say, or it's the whore. And so, dear Holy Community in Bohemia, the Manifesto concludes, the Manifesto of 1412, let us stand in battle line with our head, Master Huss, and our leader, Master Jerome, and whoever will be a Christian, let him turn to us. In other words, we are the real Christians, their manifesto says. Let everyone gird on his sword, let brother not spare brother, nor father spare son, nor son father, nor neighbor spare neighbor. All should kill, so that we can make our hands holy in the blood of the accursed ones, as Moses shows us in his books. For what is written there is an example to us. So they're going straight, hardcore, old school, Old Testament, eye for an eye. We are the real Christians, and by God, anyone who says otherwise, we're going to slew and spill their blood. So there's a bloodthirsty tone to this Hussite uprising in 1412 in Bohemia, in Central Europe. The outcome was predictable, says Jones. Demonstrations in the street led to assaults on priests and a number of arrests. The mob talked about a radical change of government, a revolution based on Huss's translation of Wycliffe's ideas. In particular, Wycliffe claimed that dominion, the right to rule, resulted from grace. So sin, which meant a loss of grace, meant the loss of political legitimacy. Sin transformed a legitimate ruler into a usurping tyrant who could be swept from office by a quote-unquote holy nation, e.g. the mob in the streets of Prague. Kind of reminds you of Rod and Todd in The Simpsons. I'm closer to Jesus. No, I'm closer to Jesus. The propaganda campaign against the church lasted from 1412 until the revolution of 1419. The Hussites staged obscene and blasphemous processions throughout Prague, ridiculing the official church through songs, pictures, and dramaturgy. As before, the magnet for popular wrath was the monasteries. Jerome of Prague was involved in 3 separate attacks on monasteries in 1414, in which excrement was smeared on the crucifixes, one of his favorite psychological warfare techniques, kind of like the fags in the church in New York, you know, throwing around condoms. Haman, who I presume is a Jew professor that Jones is quoting, Haman calls Zizka, quote, the implacable destroyer of those whom he considered the arch sinners, the monks. Zizka's hatred of the monks was notorious. So notorious, in fact, that a legend that his sister had been raped by a monk was created to explain his hatred. Žižka was drawn to the Czech nationalism promoted by revolutionary priests. Both Žižka and the priest began by identifying ecclesia with regnum, that would be church and state, and then moved to the creation of a de facto national church. When Jerome of Prague referred to Bohemia as a quote-unquote holy nation, he made no distinction between regnum and ecclesia. Similarly, the idea of pope and emperor, the lords temporal and spiritual, would merge too. What made the merger possible was the appeal to the Old Testament. Bohemia had supplanted the church as the quote-unquote new Israel. That meant the Hussite Revolution would produce generals that promoted theology, i.e. someone like Žižka, as a devoted supporter of the lay chalice, the prime bone of theological contention, who used each military campaign to promote the four articles of the Hussite faith. But it would also produce sword-wielding priests like Jerome of Prague, John Zelivsky, and most notably Prokop the Bald. Inspired by Israelite genocide in the Old Testament, the Hussite warriors of God earned a reputation for cruelty. Haman claims Žižka, quote, always insisted on sparing the lives of women and children, unquote, but that didn't prevent him from exercising a, quote-unquote, holy hatred on those whom he considered the enemies of the law of God, above all monks. So what you have here is the Catholic historian quoting the Jew historian more or less praising these breakaway Hussite revolutionaries. Jones making the point that, look, these early breakaway we are the real church Bohemians are more or less in a league with Jews back then, and they're supported by Jewish historians even today. So Žižka is one of these revolutionary military leaders, and he hates monks. During his attack on the castle of Sedlec, S-E-D-L-E-C, Žižka told six captured prisoners that if one were prepared to decapitate the others, his life would be spared. The man who volunteered was then invited to join Žižka's army. In October of 1414, Jakubek of Stříbro, another priest in Prague, began celebrating the Eucharist sub utraque specie with the faithful, and that's a Catholic term, I'm not sure what it means. What seemed like a minor liturgical issue had developed deep political consequences. The Hussites' position was that Christ had celebrated the Eucharist under both species at the Last Supper was met by Catholic insistence that only priests and bishops were in attendance then, and that only they had always communed sub utraque specie by consuming the body and blood of Christ under the appearance of both bread and wine at Mass. The Hussites' position, known as Utrachism, led them to affirm the priesthood of all believers, which they implemented at the communist settlement of Tabor, or Tabor, by using women to participate in the act of consecration. The priesthood of the laity was an oxymoron that would usher in revolutionary change throughout Christendom. So they're, you know, liberalizing in the way, you know, oh, let's use women, let's use lay. We don't have to do what the Catholics are doing. What they're doing is wrong. The monks are evil. We need to bring back primitive Christianity, and we do it by changing the rituals and the rites and the prayers and through bloodshed. The Council of Constance immediately condemned the lay chalice, which had become the symbol of the Hussite Reformation. So this is a reformation among the followers of John Huss in Bohemia in the 1400s, which the Catholic Church proper is denouncing. But it's a reformation that precedes Martin Luther's Reformation, the one that we know as the Reformation. The council then invited Huss to explain himself. The council threatened all who partook of both species at Mass with a ban of heresy and excommunication. So they're saying, if you follow this Huss and you partake in his new rites, you are excommunicated. The council then invited Huss to explain himself. Huss had ignored similar invitations before, but he accepted this time, despite his fears, after receiving a guarantee of safe conduct from Sigismund, king of the Romans. He set out for the council on October 11th, 1414, under the protection of Lords Wenceslas of Duba, UBA, and representative of the University of Prague, Master John Cardinal, Cardinal. Huss nevertheless made out his last will and testament before he left, so he's going to defend himself before the church. 2 days after arriving in Constance, Huss received the document assuring his safe conduct from the emperor. On November 28, however, he was summoned from his lodging, and despite the protest of John of Clum, C-H-L-U-M, placed under arrest. When Sigismund arrived on Christmas Eve, he lodged a protest, but by the first of the year he was reconciled to ratifying whatever the council decided. Huss was then spirited off to Gottlieben Castle, where he was interrogated for months about his beliefs and put under duress to recant. Anti-Pope John XXIII, who had excommunicated Huss, was a fellow prisoner at Gottlieben after fleeing in disguise when he recognized the council intended to depose him to resolve the Great Schism. Huss told his inquisitors he had never espoused the proposition attributed to him. The inquisitors, who seemed predisposed toward his guilt, did not believe Huss's denials, nor did Sigismund. In June 1515, Huss was found guilty of espousing the heretical doctrines of John Wycliffe, including the doctrine of remanence, or denying the real presence, which he had never held. In condemning him, the council was reacting more to the movement Huss created and the dangers it posed, which continued to metastasize. Jakubek of Strebro, taking Huss's conflation of the regnum and ecclesian, church and state, to its logical conclusion, was now claiming that God had created the Bohemian people to lead the church out of bondage to Rome. The universal church had gotten the administration of the chalice wrong for 1400 years. The Bohemian church, the holy nation, the new Israel, the new headquarters of the true universal church, would now correct it. On June 15, 1415, the Council of Constance condemned Eutrachism, U-T-R-A-Q-U-I-S-M. 3 weeks later, the council condemned Huss to the stake for espousing doctrines, of which many are, God knows, he claimed, falsely ascribed to me. I don't believe it. I never believed it. I'm not sure why you would even claim that I ever believed it. On July 6, 1415, Huss was divested of all spiritual authority. His tonsure was shaved off and replaced with a paper dunce cap bearing the figures of three demons and the words, "This is a heresiarch." Oh, cursed Judas, the bishop charged with carrying out the sentence said to Huss, who, breaking away from the councils of peace, has consulted with the Jews, we commit your soul to the devil. The faggots surrounding Huss were then lit, according to one account. He died singing. So, Huss wound up being burned at the stake as a heresiarch, and one who took counsel with Jews. The bishop's final malediction against Huss mentions accusations that dogged Huss's movement from its inception. Huss was accused of conspiring with the Jews, which discredited the movement in the eyes of the Orthodox. Most of the evidence comes from Jewish sources. Rabbi Louis Israel Newman claims the Hussite Revolution was a, quote, conspiracy between Hussites, Waldensians, and Jews. Huss was thus stigmatized as a Judaizer. And that's a big term in Jones. It's someone who is kind of backsliding or going along with the Jews in working against the church and its true beliefs and rights. His followers were stigmatized as Jews or worse than Jews, and the Hussite movement was characterized as Judaism. The charge was based on the Hussite tendency to portray their cause in Old Testament terms, but there were other reasons. Newman claims the Hussites had personal associations with individual Jews. So a Jewish historian is saying the Hussites had personal associations with individual Jews and Jewish communities in their country. He also claims Jewish groups participated actively and publicly on the rise and spread of the Hussite movement. According to Newman, Jewish support of heretical movements, especially when they threaten to spill over into political revolutions, run like dark threads through the history of nearly every movement of reform in European Christendom. So basically, they're saying, if any group that rises up against the Roman Church is shot through with Jews helping it along, or even leading it, or even creating it themselves. This is a common Catholic traditionalist claim. Here with backing from a Jewish historian named Newman. Newman also sees the Hussite revolt as, quote, the second important movement to challenge the authority of the Catholic Church. after the Albigensian, Waldensian heresy in Languedoc and Lombardy had been crushed, the impulse to revolt was transplanted to other countries, and during the 15th century gave birth to the Bohemian Reformation. So this is before Luther, 100 years before Luther, in the Lutheran Revolution, you've got the Bohemian Reformation, led by Huss, who ends up being burned at the stake and denounced as a conspirator with the Jews. Interesting stuff. The pattern of Jews supporting Judaizers in rebellion against the church repeated itself over the next few centuries, says Jones. Before long, the trajectory was predictable. The reformers would urge a return to Scripture and the purity of the early church, which would lead to a resurrection of figures from the Old Testament as models of how to use the sword to bring about heaven on earth. So, these people are saying the church is corrupt, we need to restore the primitive purity of the church, and for our example, we will proclaim ourselves a new Israel and act as they did in the Old Testament, with genocidal massacres of unchosen nations. You understand this? This is a pattern, as Jones says, it repeats over and over from century to century. There's always people willing to take up the cudgels as the new Israel, proclaim themselves a new Israel, go out and slaughter anyone who disagrees. So, vernacular editions of the Bible, often falsified and published by Jews, were crucial. Again, remember that Luther is the first one to write the Bible in vernacular German, and what Jones is saying here is these, and national churches develop, they require vernacular versions of the Bible, and the Jews are helping this along because they see it as a way to break down the church and diminish its influence and advance their own agenda. Just as they used the nigger in 20th century America to advance their agenda, they were using the Protestants and these breakaway heretics and heresiarchs to advance their own agenda in the 1400s and 1500s in Central Europe. Vernacular editions of the Bible, often falsified and published by Jews, were crucial, leading the Bohemians to think of themselves as a quote-unquote chosen race. So too, the Puritans in England and America, who, like Christian biblicists of every period, felt a strong and immediate sense of identity with many figures in Jewish history. And again, the Puritans, not just in the Hussites in Central Europe in the 1400s, but the Puritans coming to America in the 1600s. We are the new Israel. We are the real church. We are the real new Jews. We are the real deal. Everyone hostile to us must be crushed. Doing right ain't got no end, says the Northerner and the outlaw Josie Wales. We must force everyone to go along with what we say, and that's why they're going to win, because they want to make everybody think the same way they do, as the man said in Ride with the Devil. So, for hundreds and hundreds of years, we see the same thought patterns repeating themselves. Their study of the Bible prompted the Hussites to challenge the ordained priesthood and see themselves as Israelites reincarnated with a new mission from God. Kind of like the Blues Brothers, huh? Huss compared Czechs, who would have nothing to do with Germans, to the Jews whom Nehemiah forbade to intermarry with foreigners. Citizens of Prague, whose speech was half Bohemian, half German, deserved a whipping, unquote. Huss closely, quote, sought to follow the example of the Hebrew prophet. So, we are the Bohemian nation, we are the elect, we're going to smash the Germans or anyone else who gets in our way. And we're also going to smash Rome, who claims that we are not the real church. When word of Huss's death reached Prague, fierce indignation spread, uniting the Bohemian people against Rome and the emperor. Hundreds of Bohemian lords affixed their seals to a document protesting the council's action against Huss, but their protest only earned them excommunication by the same council. The Jews of Prague joined the Christians of Bohemia in their protest. They were, of course, immune to ecclesiastical sanction, but the way in which they described Huss's death is instructive. The anonymous author of a contemporary Jewish chronicle described Huss's death as Kiddush Hashem, or sanctification of the divine name, a term Gladstein says was, quote, applied only to the martyrdom of Jews, quote, unquote. So they see Huss and his death as they would have seen the martyrdom of their own, because he was serving their purpose, just as Dubois was serving their purpose against Garvey. Gladstein cites the term as, quote, further proof that the Jews considered the Hussites were Jews. The Hussites' view of themselves was no different. Heyman says that the Hussites did not think of themselves as innovators or as creators of a new form of religion and society, but rather as restorers of the old ways of God, and as the direct successors of the people of Israel, determined to create, quote, little theocratic communities in the mountains of Bohemia, which took their names from the biblical mountains like Tabor and Oreb, and espoused a creed that was, quote, stern, Puritan, Old Testamentarian, often fanatic in its determination to purge this world for all sins and sinner by fire and sword. Doing right ain't got no end. They were classic revolutionaries in the mold of Simon Bar Kokhba at Bethar and the Jews who committed suicide at Masada, the ones battling the Romans. Less than a year after Hus's death, Jerome of Prague followed him to Constance and suffered the same fate, burning at the stake in 1416, May 30th, 1416. So these Praguish revolutionaries, when they get outside of their circle or they're captured, are being burned at the stake by the Roman Church. Jerome did not die singing. His death was long, slow, and painful. Their deaths, as the anonymous Jewish chronicler noted, rallied the Czech people around Hus, whom they declared their saint. So the Catholic Church martyred Hus by burning him at the stake. From 1416 on, the anniversary of Hus's death was celebrated in Prague. Hus and the chalice became, quote, joined from then on in a mutually reinforcing union that threatened to fall apart whenever external opposition lagged. Sigismund's brutal and stupid policies, however, ensured that that would not be happening soon. Galvanized by the death of Hus, his movement became increasingly messianic. In March 1417, the Hussite faction at the University of Prague redoubled its support of the Utraquist position, saying that communion under both species was necessary for salvation. Now, this is, I don't understand, but it's something related to the host and whether it's the real body, blood of Jesus, or the way in which it's administered. And it's, you know, it's some basically meaningless doctrinal dispute that has great meaning to the type of idiots who are attracted to that kind of idiocy. I don't number among them, obviously. But anyway, the Catholic Church kills, martyrs, Hus, and this makes the people in Prague who support Hus angry. They celebrate his death. They keep up their doctrinal dispute. They redouble their efforts. They also declared the Roman Rite invalid and made the Bohemian Hussite movement the one true Church of Christ on earth. And you see, and here's where the Catholics are very aggressive and arrogant in their conceit that science is somehow lower than religion, because every church claims to be the true church. And the beautiful thing with science, you have a way to reconcile claims. You have objective measures, but you don't have any objective measures of what's true in non-scientific things. Now, the church will claim that, you know, that's scientism, or that things can be true that can't be measured, whatever, but the fact is they're people don't fight over, you know, they don't fight over, you know, how many inches there are in a yard, or they don't fight over technical scientific things, because there's an objective way of reconciling competing claims. But that's not true when it comes to garbage like Jebuism of whichever form. Rome says this, the Hussites say that, and there's no way to tell who's right, so they fight and they die. And the agenda of the Jews, more than anyone else, is advanced by it. They say, the chalice, images of which would be sewn on the sleeves of Taborite soldiers, became the official symbol of the Bohemian Revolution, which, true to the Old Testament model, was both political and religious. 8 months after the Hussites declared spiritual independence, the Council of Constance resolved the Great Schism by electing Odone, Cardinal Colonna, Pope. O-D-D-O-N-E, Cardinal Colonna, C-O-L-O-N-N-A, Pope. So, Pope Martin V soon met a procession of Jews in Constance, informing them while astride a white horse with silk and gold harness, "You have the law, but understand it not." The Jews, though, hadn't come to be lectured on the Christian faith or their blindness to its truth. Still smarting from the accusations of a Jewish Hussite conspiracy, the Jews feared for their lives at the hands of Catholic crusaders, and so pleaded with the Pope for protection. Gretz, that's the Jewish historian Heinrich Graetz, G-R-A-E-T-Z, claimed the request was accompanied by large sums of money. What the Jews got for their money, although Graetz doesn't put it this way, was a reiteration of Sicut Judaeus non, that is, the Jews, as long as they're not subverting the church, must be left alone, the traditional teaching of the church on Jews. The Jews were blind, and they were a pernicious influence on Christian society, but they should not be harmed. Or, as Martin V put it, whereas the Jews are made in the image of God, and a remnant of them will one day be saved, and whereas they have besought our protection, following in the footsteps of our predecessors, we command that they not be molested in synagogues, that their rights, laws, customs not be assailed, that they be not baptized by force, constrained to observe Christian festivals, nor to wear new badges, and that they not be hindered in their business relations with Christians. And what this has done is ultimately undermine the church itself, because it's too liberal. The correct policy toward the Jews is extermination. And that's what I, as an atheist and a proud white man, will continue to advocate, because it's good for me and my family and my people and my race. It's good that Jews be exterminated, because they mean to exterminate us. And you have to bring a gun to a gunfight, and a bunch of water dripped on your head by some pederastic priest is not a gun. It's a nothing. And yeah, I'm undermining faith. If citing the facts of the matter is undermining the faith, then the faith needs to be undermined. And E. Michael Jones will have to understand that. Because, know as much as he might of this history, he is simply wrong in interpreting a lot of his facts. And that's why I'm doing this show. Teach people that the church cannot overcome biology with holy water. Race is real. Race exists. And if you want to take a religious view, God made it that way. And your conceit may end up destroying your own kind, because God, obviously, whether you accept the Old Testament or whether you accept the evidence, God has no problem with extinction. 99% of the species that ever existed on Earth are as dead as the Archaeopteryx we talked about at the start of the show. A dinosaur bird that lived, 250 million years ago. There's nothing wrong with making the Jews extinct. Martin V was not as lenient or as understanding with the Hussites. A few months after his election in spring 1418, Martin V, in conjunction with the council, which dissolved in April, sent King Wenceslas 24 recommendations to rid Bohemia of the Hussite heretics and to repair what they vandalized and restore what they stole. On April 22nd, Martin appealed to Sigismund to enforce the decrees, granting him the right to organize a crusade against the heretics. Each time the Council of Constance tried to impose order by force in Bohemia, it united a people that otherwise threatened to dissolve into warring factions, unable to resolve internal theological differences without recourse to force of arms. Martin V demanded that Huss's followers publicly approve his condemnation and execution. Coupled with the economic boycott imposed on Bohemia and the threat of a crusade, Martin V's demand united the Bohemian nation behind the most radical Hussite leaders. So, the church is trying to bring these back in the fold, but the political abilities of its pope are weak. And instead of downplaying this stuff and allowing it to peter out and be divided among warring factions and eventually die down, he is building it up against his intention by boycotting it and denouncing it and saying that all of its leaders ought to be destroyed and ought to lever a new crusade against it. So, great political skill was obviously lacking in this pope, even though the church would eventually triumph over these early Bohemian reformers or new churchers or heretics. Call them what you like. And so, as the Pope and the Catholic Church are holding councils and repairing this schism in the church and trying to deal with heretics, they end up reinforcing the most radical leaders of these Prague-ists, who have already seen their main guy, Huss, be burned at the stake, and they've seen, Jerome, also be burned at the stake, and they don't like this, and they're being reinforcing their radicalism by a politically inept pope. In the spring of 1419, so again, this is all going on in the lands our ancestors came from 600 years ago. Think about how time goes by. It's not all that long ago, really. Time goes pretty quickly. 600 years ago, this is what was going on. In the spring of 1419, John Zalewski, a violent revolutionary priest, became de facto dictator of Prague. Zalewski was an apostate monk who never missed an opportunity to attack the institution he had abandoned. So he's a former monk who's attacking the monks, leading the people against the monks, and leading them against the church in Rome. Zalewski was a sword-wielding priest who aspired to be Žižka's equal as a military leader. He failed miserably as a military leader, but he was adept at agitprop and mobilizing the mob for violence, which culminated in the defenestration that touched off the revolution. You may have heard of the defenestration of Prague. Well, this is it. Now, in German, the word for window is... defenestration means to throw someone out a window. In German, and I think that that's Latin, fenestra is window in Latin, and fenster in German is a window. And defenestration means to throw someone out of a window. And so the defenestration we're going to see touched off the actual revolution. Up till now, they've, you know, preachers, and they've been burned at the stake, and there hasn't been a hell of a lot of bloodshed yet, but there's a lot of angry words, and there's a definite camp of heretics set up, or the new church if you take them on their own terms. The transition from priest to revolutionary is discernible in Zalewski's sermons, which became progressively more revolutionary and violent during 1419. Zalewski turned Sigismund's unfortunate use of words in creating an, quote, order of the dragon, unquote, into the claim that Sigismund was the Antichrist. The second coming of Christ was thus at hand, and Prague had a special role to play. And this is the thing. Every idiot who reads... The Bible is written in a very Jewy spirit. It's very nasty, mean-spirited, full of genocide and hate. And to people who are without a sense of humor or any perspective or any particular learning, that stuff is like catnip. And, of course, who do they see it? Well, obviously, we're living in special times, and we're a special nation of people, and it all comes down to me, and let's get out there and kill people and prove all this craziness. I mean, honest to God, if you go around to garage sales around here, about 40% of the houses, if they have any books at all, are going to have that kind of left-behind crap. People cannot accept that they're just run-of-the-mill, there's nothing special about them, they don't belong to an elect nation, and there's no, you know, greater meaning to their lives than what there manifestly is. And so there's always this standing temptation just because of the way people are and the way Jews and Jewy writers know to appeal to them to take up, you know, to take war against some people for some wholly irrational reason gotten out of the Bible written by their racial enemies. And this is true not just today, but this has been true for, you know, since time immemorial. It's absolute insanity. But, you know, just as it, here in Kirksville, Missouri today, this kind of appeal would probably work. Back then it worked in Bohemia. Oh, yeah, we're a special nation. Got a special mission to fulfill. Got to take out those monks. The Jews will help us battle down the church in Rome. So, anyway, we said Martin V demanded that Huss's followers, Huss having been burned at the stake, demands that his followers publicly approve his condemnation and execution. Back then, the Pope wasn't kissing Jew ash. They were burning heretics at the stake. So that meant that, you know, shitting on the church as the satirist at Saturday Night Live or the fags at whatever that church was in New York... There's no actual cost to be paid for that today. Well, back then, if you spoke against the church, there might be a crusade undertaken against you, and you might well end up atop a pile of faggots, burning to death. Back then, the faggots in the church were pieces of wood. Today, they're often the priests themselves, as Jones writes about in another issue of Culture Wars, if we ever get around to discussing that. So... Huss has been killed. Jerome has been killed. We've got John Zalewski in 1419, a violent priest whose sermons are growing harsher and harsher over the course of 1419. is not a good military leader, but a very good at agitprop and mobilizing the mob, as Jones says. And the defenestration will ultimately touch off the revolution. The transition from priest to revolutionary is discernible in his 1919 sermons. And Zelivsky turns Sigismund's unfortunate use of words in creating an order of the dragon into the claim that, okay, this guy created an order of the dragon, well, he must be the Antichrist. Who else would create an order of the dragon? This is how religious people think. The second coming of, and you see these humorless, brainless people going to the Bible, and you can see their fat, stupid lips, you know, sounding out the words and making a parallel from people they don't like in everyday life to you know, creatures mentioned in Revelation. And this is how these wacko Christians think, regardless of which side they're on. They're insane. And they're dangerous to all around them. Today they're dangerous in a different form. You know, they bring in Somalis and whatever, and thinking they're doing the work of the Lord, and doing right ain't got no end. Like Twain said, the moral sense is what separates us from the animals. He meant it in the negative way, whereas people like Jones mean it in the positive way. It's the moral sense that makes us worse than animals. There's a lot to be said for that point of view. Although we do need, you know, some kind of way of living with other people. We can't all be anchorites or hermits. So if we live with others, we have to live in a way that makes communal living possible. The Bible and its commandments are one approach at coming up with the rules. Not the only approach, though, as they claim. Or the only true approach. So anyway, you know, of course the idiots have to believe that the second coming of Christ was at hand, and Prague had a special role to play. The holy nation of Bohemia was going to inaugurate the millennium. That's what millennialism means. Oh, it means the return of Christ and his rule for 1,000 years. Christ's reign, heaven on earth, the time had come for God's holy nation to grab the sword and bring on the millennium. We can't just let it happen. We have to catalyze it. We have to make it happen. We do that with our special gift of our gift of song. No, not our gift of song. We're not Miss America contestants. We do it with our gift of sword. We do it by chopping people up. That will prove that we're right. And this is what Jimmy Cantrell, the writer who doesn't write much anymore, at least on the internet, would say is the typical of Germanic or Anglo-Saxon or people is they're forcing others to do right or be good or killing them. Just as, you know, we force Iraq to be democratic, we kill 1 million of their people and we unhouse 1 million, 4 or 5 million of their people, make them refugees, and we're forcing them to be good. Being good means complying with our dictates. The time had come for God's holy nation to grab the sword and bring on the millennium. Intoxicated by his rhetoric, the mob in Prague began to bring on the millennium by vandalizing images, often destroying whole churches and beating up Catholic priests or monks unfortunate enough to be caught in the street alone. To whip the masses into a revolutionary frenzy, Zelivsky organized processions, leading the faithful to a church with a monstrance firmly grasped in both hands, and standing back as the mob vandalized the church under this blasphemous sanction. I think the monstrance is, I think that's what they put the little wafers, the discs, in, and, you know, I'm not sure I'm right about that, though. But it's some kind of religious object. And standing back as the mob vandalized the church under this blasphemous sanction during the late spring and summer of 1419, as Wenceslas IV lost control of his capital city and his kingdom, the revolutionary priests staged blasphemous processions featuring bare-breasted whores, riding beasts symbolizing the whore of Babylon from the Book of Revelations. And again, it's Jones fucks up here. He doesn't have bare-breasted hyphenated. He starts going back in these pages to the incredibly shittily edited Libido Dominandi, I mean, it, which is shittily edited throughout. This one has actually been pretty good for the first 150 pages, but I start to see mistakes creep in here. It's not Revelations, it's Revelation. Singular. Don't get that wrong. It's like Illinois. It's not Illinois. It's Illinois. Alright, so We can only wish there were videos that could be stuck on YouTube of these bare-breasted whores riding beasts symbolizing the whore of Babylon from the Book of Revelations. You can imagine this is a lot of fun for the people. In addition to being bloody, violent, and stupid, it's a lot of fun. The rest of the whore's body was covered with scrolls representing papal bulls and tiny bells that tinkled in mockery of the bells rung during the consecration of Mass. The riotous procession eventually wound its way to the new town square, where a fire was kindled and the bulls, those are the papal orders, stripped from the whore's body and were burnt in defiance. Festivals and processions of this sort, replete with obscenity and blasphemy, served as visual and dramatic propaganda that tended toward temporal subversion of the social order. And the Catholic conceit is that they alone, being the true church, can sustain the social order, and you have to pay attention to what they say and accept no others. For a time, the world was turned upside down. The lecherous whore played the virgin or pope. The fool became the bishop. The criminal donned the king's crown. The ass brayed at the altar while everyone ran leaping through the cathedral, singing uproariously the drunken liturgy. So they're having some fun here. Kind of like Mardi Gras or something. Revolutionary Mardi Gras. Hussite songs would play an even more crucial role in the revolution. The most famous was Ye Warriors of God. Hussite warriors could win battles just by singing Ye Warriors of God, because its melody would throw opposing armies into panic. Oh shit, they're coming. I have to find that. There must be someone who knows the words and soon, and probably has created a video on a YouTube. I'm going to find that and link that in the show notes. Every show that we do is archived and usually posted within 24 hours by our top flight archivist, and if I can find that, if there's a recording of it, I'll post that. And so these crazy people, these crazy Christian revolutionaries called Hussites or Hussites, followers of the burned at the stake John Hus in 1419, are scaring the shit out of their opponents just by playing their song, Ye Warriors of God. Even the music had an Old Testament referent. Ziska seemed a reincarnation of Joshua, the Jewish military leader in the Old Testament, and the Hussites were bringing the walls of Jericho down with their music. But the connection was in the music too, or at least in the lyrics. In Arise, Arise, Great City of Prague, the Hussites call upon God to protect them, quote, against the king of Babylon who threatens the city of Jerusalem, Prague, and all faithful people. We are the real ones. You know, the cry of the tantrumic activity, the cry of the two-year-old who's an adult. You know, we are the real church. We're going to kill anyone who says otherwise. Hussite propaganda could only subvert the medieval ecclesiastical order by appealing to models from the Old Testament. If Bohemia were now Israel, then Prague was Jerusalem, and if Prague were Jerusalem, then Rome must be Babylon, and so on. And this is the way morons always think like this. Always do they think like this. We are special. No, you sure are special. The logic of analogy was essential to the revolutionary project because it was the only way the revolutionaries could legitimize their cause. Metaj, M-A-T-E-J, of Janov, we are told, J-A-N-O-V, we are told, had earlier written in his Narracia del Milicio that the Jerusalem experiment founded by John Millick, M-I-L-I-C, of Cromeries, K-R-O-M-E-R-I-Z, was the beginning of a divine action through Christ to create from Prague, formerly a city of Babylon, full of filth and shame, a city of light upon a hill. Jerusalem. Again, the parallels to the American founding by the Puritans. These appeals to the Old Testament delegitimized a social order based on the Catholic Church and its appropriation of classical culture. The cultural agitprop proved it possible to construe sacred realities in another compelling way. So, the Catholic position is, look, we're the civilized here. Our monks, without any children, and through their vows of chastity, obedience, and poverty, have built up agriculture. They've civilized these barbarians. They've brought the learning of the old order from Greece and Rome, and they've more or less created a Europe. Otherwise, it would just be a bunch of tribes going at it, as was the case in the New World at this time, before the white man arrived, 1492. So that's the Catholic position. But the Prague revolutionaries, the Hussites, the followers of John Hus, see it otherwise. They see the monks as the bad guys, the Roman Church as the whore of Babylon, as seen in Revelation. And they themselves, I'm the new Jeremiah, I'm going to lead my people to freedom, this kind of thing. The mass gatherings on the hills throughout the summer of 1419 showed that an alternative society where there was neither lord nor servant, nor mine nor thine, as a communist aspect of it, was possible. The Hussites named these Woodstock-like gatherings on the hills Tabor, after the mountain in Palestine where Jesus was transfigured and appeared in glory alongside Moses and Elijah. Now, I apologize for not knowing whether it's Tabor or Tabor, but anyway, the Hussites are gathering in the hills, and they're calling this Tabor. So they became known as Taborites, let's say. Let's hope it's pronounced that way. So I guess Tabor, biblically, is a mountain in Palestine where Jesus was transfigured and appeared in glory alongside Moses and Elijah. Napoleon would stand on Tabor centuries later after defeating the Ottoman Turks in a moment of apotheosis that led many Jews to proclaim him the Messiah. Tabor, in turn, towered over the plains of Megiddo, where, it is said, the Antichrist would fight his final battle. And you may remember our own FBI undermining black nationalists yesteryear, undermining white nationalists this year, around 2000, had a project named Megiddo, or Megiddo, M-E-G-I-D-D-O, in which they wrote up white nationalists and how the turn of the millennium was likely to lead them to radical activity. In Bohemia in 1419, Tabor symbolized the alternative to the Catholic social order. Remember, the subtitle of Jones's magazine is No Progress Outside the Moral Order. And so they're saying that Catholics have the morals and the way to live down, and you need to follow them, and if you don't, you're trying to make progress outside their moral order. So Tabor and these gatherings, these Woodstock-like gatherings in the hills and Bohemia, are presented as an alternative to the Catholic social order symbolized by the monasteries that the revolutionaries hated. Tabor was an assembly in nature, outside the city and therefore outside of history and the sinful accretions of Roman culture. Tabor was the locus and is the focal point of the transfiguration, a manifestation of glory in the here and now. In the gospel, Jesus warns his disciples not to erect permanent structures on Tabor, a warning that stresses how fleeting glory and exaltation are in this world. The Judaizing Taborite priests, however, impose the opposite meaning. Tabor was to be the basis of a new social order. During the summer of 1419, thousands of peasants abandoned their farms, cottages, wives, and families to live on top of a hill near Usti, U-S-T-I, overlooking the Luznice River, according to the new dispensation. Nothing, Norman Cohn says, could show more clearly the extent to which these people lived in and from eschatological fantasies than the names which they gave to this town and to the river beneath it. While the latter became the Jordan, the former became Tabor, that is to say, the Mount of Olives, where Christ had foretold his Parousia, P-A-R-O-U-S-I-A, where he had ascended to heaven and where, traditionally, he was expected to reappear in majesty, I guess to herald the millennium. It was Tabor which became the spiritual center of the whole radical movement. So these Hussites are gathering in the hills outside of the cities and giving them biblical names and feeling they're part of a new dispensation or a new order, and Jesus is going to return. The Taborite settlement in Bohemia was the locus of different movements, iconoclasm, communism. Mine and thine do not exist at Tabor. Whoever owns private property commits a mortal sin. So this is the kind of we would see this in the scientific or the utopian socialism, such as exhibited in America in New Harmony, Indiana, in the 1800s, where they're trying to set up these communes. So this is a recurring theme in Western histories, people rejecting what Jones would call the true church and trying to bring about a new order. Millennialism, Adventism, and if we include the Adamites, who were eventually expelled, nudism and sexual liberation. And that's one of Jones's big themes in his other book, that sexual liberation is political revolution. They're rejecting the Catholic social order, and that means they're going to embrace murder and lust and all of the other sins. But they were united in their revolutionary messianic politics derived from their reading of the Old Testament. That's a crucial sentence. So that they're they're putting themselves in the position of the Jews in the Old Testament, and they're going to bring about a new Israel because they are the true church. The Taborites, Newman says, were dominated by Old Testament influence almost to the same degree as the Puritans of England and early America. Like the Puritans, they compared themselves to the ancient Israelites, regarded themselves as God's chosen people, and denounced their foes as impious Canaanites, inhabitants of Edom, Moab, and Amalek, as they designated the adjacent German provinces. So we are the holy Bohemian nation, and we are the new Israel and the new church, and our opponents are in the German lands around us are the bad guys, the Canaanites, the Edomites, the Moabites, and the Amalekites. Newman says the Taborites rejected the entire ecclesiastical ritual system and held invocation of saints to be heretical and idolatrous. So they're rejecting the Roman rites. They based their iconoclasm. Iconoclasm means attempting to destroy existing institutions. They based their iconoclasm on Old Testament injunctions against image worship. Like the Israelites, the Hussites favored an elective king. They attempted to get the first Polish king and then his Lithuanian nephew to rule them. Like Cromwell and the founders of the American Republic, they based their republicanism not on classical models, but on their reading of the book of Deuteronomy. So they're trying to go again straight from the Old Testament to then modern day Bohemia in 1419. Tabor began not as a settlement, but as a rally. To use a modern analogy, the settlement at Tabor was as if the people who attended Woodstock never left, but instead created a community, which created an army, which conquered the country, and then went on military forays into Canada and Mexico, too. The success of the rally gave credence to, quote, mass secession from the established order, unquote, which began when the peasants heard the millennialism of the revolutionary priests at rallies and decided not to go home, but to set up a permanent dwelling outside the existing social order. The mass rally was itself an act of revolutionary defiance in a culture where the right to convoke a multitude was the sole prerogative of the state. Lawrence of Brezova, Brezova, was dumbfounded by the novelty of large masses of people congregating on hills. He consulted astrologers for an explanation, eventually concluding Saturn had set the mob in motion and inclined their minds toward rebelling against their superiors. The uneducated peasants thought the end of the age was at hand, especially since the priests were telling them that, with citations from Daniel and Revelations to prove it. So, these religious nuts, they always draw from the Old Testament, and they draw from Revelation, and they reject the majority of the New Testament, and they believe they're the true Israel, and by these Old Testament ways, they're going to ensconce themselves in power by killing anyone who resists. The gatherings began during the summer of 1419 as an extension of the cultural agitprop priests like Zelivsky were promoting in Prague. Kaminsky calls Tabor a conspiracy which had diverse heads, but its tails were all tied together, meaning Zelivsky was coordinating activities that linked the revolutionaries in Prague with those in southern Bohemia. Zelivsky preached sermons above about the meaning of the biblical Mount Tabor while revolutionaries were gathered on the similarly named hill on a promontory in the Luznice River. The rhetoric of his sermons made him sound like a prophet predicting the future. When the king learned of this revolutionary activity, the pace of events increased dramatically. On July 6, 1419, the king replaced Newtown city councillors with personally picked opponents of the Hussites, but the king had waited too long. The incessant propaganda against throne and altar had turned Prague against him. Then Zelivsky and the other revolutionary priests forced the issue. The radical wing of the Hussite movement convoked a meeting on a hill near Bechyne, B-E-C-H-Y-N-E. On July 22nd, between 40 and 50,000 people showed up. Taborite contingents from throughout Bohemia, hill people, from throughout Bohemia arrived with priests marching before them, holding monstrances containing the body of Christ. The local Taborites were joined by contingents from the regions around Pilsen in the west, Dumaslis in the northwest, Radek Kralov in the northeast, Moravia, and of course Prague. After arrival, the people attended Mass and received the Eucharist sub ubtrace speci. Royal spies at the rally reported that a conspiracy involving Zelivsky and several other Taborite priests was afoot. Kaminsky stresses the rationality of the conspirators. They may have proclaimed the end of the world to the masses, but when it came to political action in Prague, they were not fanatics. They were at home in the world of political realities, and they knew a good deal about their king and how he acted. The most reasonable way to change his policy of reaction would be to undertake limited action, to convince him that continuing the policy would cause him more trouble than reversing it, and the most reasonable kind of action would be a coup against the hated magistrate should he had just installed. The spies did not know when the coup would occur. One chronicler claims the spies warned the king the Taborites planned to attack the royal castle of Novi Hrad in September. If the king had thought he had a month to prepare the attack, he was ill-served by their intelligence. The attack came 8 days after the mass rally at Bakhine, where it must have been planned. So things are turning violent in the summer of 1419 as the hill people, the Taborites, attempt to force the issue against the Catholics and the king, who were opposed to them. If Zalewski attended the rally at Bakhine, he could not have planned the attack after he returned to Prague. There wasn't enough time, especially since Zalewski also had to write a sermon to incite his congregants to violence as well. On Sunday morning, July 30th, 1419, Zalewski's Church of St. Mary was crowded as usual. The congregation had been told to come bearing arms, so when Zalewski told them to raise the sword, they could follow his exhortation in a literal manner. Zalewski looked to the Old Testament to find models to justify insurrection. He cited Ezekiel 6:3-5. "Behold, I, even I, will bring a sword upon you, and I will destroy your high places, and your altars shall be desolate, and your images shall be broken, and I will cast down your slain men before your idols, and I will lay dead carcasses of the children of Israel before their idols, and I will scatter your bones around your altars." Yeah, I'll do it. Zalewski's sermon was calculated to get his congregants to act on what he preached. The anonymous chronicler claims he vigorously incited the people to sedition in the city against the town councilors and those who supported them. So, again, this is July 30th, 1419. Concluding his sermon at around 8:30 a.m., Zalewski picked up a monstrance, that's the thing containing all the wafers, and urged the congregation to follow him into the streets. The fired-up congregants marched in an illegal procession to St. Stephen's Church, forced open its doors, and held an impromptu service there. Zalewski celebrated Mass, and the congregants received communion sub ubtrace specie. After Mass, Zalewski again picked up the monstrance. This time he led the mob to the new town hall, where, although it was Sunday morning, a number of city councilmen had gathered, probably to discuss what to do about Zalewski. Hearing the mob outside, the mayor and a number of the town magistrates, all wearing the chains that were the insignia of their office, went to the window and began an ill-advised colloquy with the mob, which demanded release of Hussite prisoner. The mayor might have been stalling for time. A troop of mounted horsemen had already been dispatched from Radkani Castle across the river to disperse the mob. However, the mob, having heard sermon after sermon about sinful men being cast down to destruction from high places, was in no mood to negotiate with the Antichrist or his minions. The confrontation grew more heated until someone claimed a magistrate threw a stone at Zalewski, who was standing off to the side, holding the monstrance containing the sacred species. The mob then rushed the door to the new hall, broke the bolts holding it shut, and swarmed upstairs where they murdered some of the councilmen on the spot and threw the others out of the window, thereby giving the first successful revolution of its kind on European soil its name, i.e., the first defenestration of Prague. The second took place in the 30 Years' War. So, on July 30th, 1419, these Hussites, who are fired up by this guy Zalewski, Z-E-L-I-V-S-K-Y, go to the center of the town and attack the mayor and the magistrates and kill some of them and throw other ones out the window. The defenestration of Prague. The first, 1419, July 30th. These religious revolutionaries were heated up with rhetoric from the Old Testament and see themselves as the chosen nation, the new Israel, and their Bohemians, Taborites from the hills. Hills given the Old Testament names. Those who survived the fall from being thrown out the window were set upon by the mob outside the hall and slain. The golden chains of office were left on their bodies as if to indicate the symbols of office had lost their legitimacy. So Jones is saying this is like the first true revolution in Europe, but not the last. During the carnage, Zelivsky stood by, holding up his monstrous and urging the mob not to be reticent about shedding the blood of the Antichrist and his minions. The anonymous chronicler says, while the slaughter was going on, the priest called John, bearing the body of Christ, continued to incite the people. He also says, John Ziska, King Wenceslas's most personal attendant, was present at the slaying of the counselors. This probably explains the coup's stunning success. Not only were the councilmen overpowered in their own bastion, the troops of horses sent to rescue them were also turned back, and the hall was quickly turned into a garrison by the Hussites. The Hussites. The chronicler adverts to Ziska's treachery, too. As a personal attendant to the king, he broke a personal oath of allegiance when he engaged in the insurrection, a fact generally brought up only by Catholic commentators. Hoefler, H-O-E-F-L-E-R, mentions Ziska's solemn oath and compares him in his impiety to George Washington, although not the way Whiggish historians usually do, as an example of treason justified only by saying that the end justifies the means. The revolution, when it is successful, justifies the oath-breaking impiety of those who would otherwise be condemned. Even Lawrence of Brzozowa, the moderate Hussite who knew that Ziska committed an act of grave disobedience toward the king in whose service he was bound, characterizes Ziska as an extraordinary defender of the law of Christ. The successful attack on Newhall indicates Ziska was privy to the planning of the operation. This was not a haphazard, ad hoc outburst of pent-up emotion that would spend itself in looting and then burn itself out as quickly as it had sprung up. The Hussites installed their own government and neutralized political opposition. The defenestration meant the revolution had reached, quote, the absolute point of no return. So they've gone from talking to acting, to taking power, to installing their own people, all on July 30th, 1419. The revolutionary regime had been established, you know, like the Jews would communize and set up Kurt Eisner in Bavaria, in Munich, when they made a successful coup, and Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht wanted to do the same thing up north in Berlin. The revolutionary regime had been established, and now it would serve, as all true revolutions claim to do, as a model for the rest of the world. So they want this revolution to take place not just where it has succeeded, but everywhere, in order to ensure its safety and stability, continuance. On August 13th, Zelivsky, 2 weeks later, after this bloody successful uprising, Zelivsky preached an exultant sermon claiming that Prague, quote, now, at this time, unquote, was the model for all the faithful, not only in Moravia, but in Hungary, Poland, and Austria, unquote. 3 days later, King Wenceslas suffered a second stroke more severe than his first, which happened when word of the insurrection reached him. And he died the same night, quote, roaring like a lion, unquote, in pain, as Lawrence of Brzozowa put it. There was now no king to oppose the revolution. A town council installed by the revolution claimed to be the rightful government of Prague. Heyman comments, important inhibitions to open revolutionary action disappeared, unquote. The king died without an heir, complicating matters. The legitimate claimant to the throne was now Sigismund, who had allowed the Council of Constance to burn John Hus and Jerome of Prague at the stake. So, it's getting pretty deep. A day after the king's death, the looting of the monasteries began. The first to go was the great chapter of the House of Carthusians at Smikhov, S-M-I-C-H-O-V. The monastery's wealth had made them an object of envy for the entire social spectrum in Bohemia, from nobles to peasants. Hatred of the monasteries united priests like Zelivsky and soldiers like Ziska. The German heritage of many monks fueled the Czech nationalism inherent in the Hussite rebellion as well. One of the great monuments to medieval culture went up in flames. So we're seeing the end of the medieval era and the rise of the revolutionary era, where these religiously inflamed nuts, often thinking in ethnic nationalist terms as well, are creating havoc, burning monasteries, proclaim themselves the new Israel. The Jews were unmolested in the looting, even though they were usually the first victims of the mob in medieval towns. Haman considers this, quote, a remarkable fact. especially if one considers the religious fervor underlying the movement and remembers that the Jews were often considered the servants of Antichrist. So these Hussite revolutionaries are not bothering the Jews, which is a significant sign. The Taborite gatherings continued after the defenestration. On September 17th, a large gathering of Hussites assembled near Pilsen. Less than 2 weeks later, an equally large assembly took place at Nakritskak, which I guess means at the crosses, near Benešov, not far from Prague. Zelivsky must have been busy in Prague during the rally at Nakritskak, N-A, new word, K-R-I-Z-K-A-C-H, Kritskak, because the star of the show there was Wenceslas Koranda, K-O-R-A-N-D-A, but personality was irrelevant. All Taborite priests thought of themselves as Old Testament warriors. Brethren, Koranda told the mob at Nakritskak, the time has come to lay down the staff of the pilgrim and take up the sword. It was at Nakritskak Koranda first met Ziska. Fired up by Koranda's servants, the Taborites moved from Nakritskak to Prague, arriving there after dark, where they met by John Zelivsky at the head of a torch-bearing mob. The church bells rang in their honor. The following day, the mob broke into local churches and defaced crucifixes and other works of sacred art. The radical Taborite clergy rapidly consolidated power in Prague under Zelivsky's leadership. In their manifestos, which began showing up in university towns across Europe from Leipzig to Cambridge, the Hussites denounced the Pope as the Antichrist and his clergy as the priests of Pharaoh and followers of Satan. True to the Judaizing paradigm, they called themselves, quote, faithful fighters of God, unquote, and compared themselves to the Maccabees, the Jews who fought Rome. But an anti-Hussite reaction was building, one which satirized their reliance on Old Testament models to subvert the social order. When, the anti-Hussites wrote, our Moses, Ziska, the executioner, talks to God, then the Hussites will strike their clubs against the rock, water will come forth from the rock, and when you cross the Danube on dry ground, like the Israelites of Jordan, when this happens, all the land beyond the Danube will belong to you. Something like the satire actually happened when the Hussite armies invaded German lands to the north of Bohemia. Under the leadership of the warrior priest Prokop the Bald, Hussite armies would march undefeated all the way to the Baltic. By late October, hundreds of Taborite revolutionaries had streamed into Prague from the provinces. The first pitched military battle of the Hussite rebellion occurred when the Taborites, on their way to Prague, ran into royalist troops near Zivohost, Z-I-V-O-H-O-S-T, and suffered heavy losses. Fighting soon broke out in Prague, too. On October 25th, Ziska stormed Visehrad, V-Y-S-E-H-R-A-D, the royal castle on the old town side of the Vltava, V-L-T-A-V-A, successfully wresting it from royalist troops. Now the city was open to Taborite movement from the south, even if movement from the west was still cut off by Hradčany Castle. So they control parts of Prague, but access routes in are controlled by the king and the Catholic loyalists, and they're doing battle here in 1419. Now let's see. There's a good deal more of this. It's quite interesting stuff. And we're not going to be able to cover it all today, but we will keep going here for a while. Now, he says, when news of the defeat of the Taborites at Zivohost reached Prague, a group of radical priests under Ambrose of Hradec Kralov, K-R-A-L-O-V-E, attacked the royalist positions across the river. After initial success, including forcing Queen Sophie to flee from Hradčany, they were able to prevail, thus leaving Hradčany in the hands of the royalists. And so, he says, during the winter, so these radical sermons and defenestration happen in the summer of 1419, and then all these battles begin as they're fighting to expand their power. During the winter of 1419-1420, millennialist fever increasingly took over the Hussite movement. During this time, Lawrence of Brzozowa wrote, certain Taborite priests were preaching to the people a new coming of Christ, in which all evil men and enemies of the truth would perish and be exterminated, while the good would be preserved in five cities. Lawrence of Brzozowa was not unsympathetic to the revolutionaries, yet he concluded the devil took over the movement that winter, leading many Taborite priests, quote, to reject the doctrines of the church fathers and of the church tradition, and to interpret scripture on their own. According to the new Taborite hermeneutic, or interpretation, everything necessary to the salvation of man here on earth is sufficiently expressed in the New Testament. However, any interpretation necessary to understand the New Testament can be drawn from the Old, for the two laws expound each other. That hermeneutic would lead inexorably to the preeminence of the Old Testament over the New, and that would affect the Taborite priests, who let their hair grow long and grew beards so they would resemble more closely the priests of the Old Testament. The priests of the Old Testament, Taborites, Lawrence tells us, quote, fleeing human traditions, walked about with beards and unshaven heads and gray clothing. They did not read the canonical hours, and without chasubles, corporals, or special chalices, they performed divine rites under the heavens or in houses, not on a holy altar, but on any sort of table covered with a linen cloth. Nor did they observe the rite of the Mass by saying the collects with a canon, but all at once the priest would kneel with the brethren, place their heads on the ground, and pray the Lord's Prayer. Then the one who was to make the sacrament of the altar got up and said in a loud and intelligible voice, in the vernacular, no more than the words of consecration over the hosts and the wine. So they are radically vernacularizing the masses in a way consistent with their radical beliefs that they think are modeled on the Old Testament. John Prebham also noticed a change in the movement that winter of 1419-1420. Priests like Wenceslas Caranda were changed by Old Testament rhetoric of their own sermons into, quote, seducers, unquote, who began to preach enormous cruelty, unheard of violence, and injustice to man. They said that now was the time of vengeance, the time of destruction of all sinners, and the time of God's wrath, in which all the evil and sinful ones were to perish by sudden death. On one day, those cruel beasts, the Taborite priests, wanting to excite and work up the people so that they would not shrink from vengeance, so that the people should strike and kill all sinners. In which all the evil and sinful ones were to perish by sudden death. So just we see today that priests can be super wimpy, and all God's Jesus loves all the children of the world. They're either fags or they're really wimpy liberals. And they could also go wrong in the direction of being crazed, bloodthirsty revolutionaries, wanting to excite and work up the people so that they would not shrink from these afflictions, preached that it was no longer the time of mercy, but the time of vengeance, so that the people should strike and kill all sinners. And they called us and others who admonished them to be merciful, damaging hypocrites. The rhetoric of revolution was drawn from historical events described in the Old Testament, but the revolution had its own inner logic, says Jones, its own formal causality that would be repeated in subsequent revolutions. Plato had described it as metabolia, a quasi-natural transformation of one form of government into another, as Hannah Arendt described the devolution from democracy to tyranny. Kaminsky says, the new communities formed in the winter of 1419-1420 were not stable societies. They were essentially mass movements with a character determined by the realities of the movement itself, unquote. So they listen to this radical preaching, and by the summer of 1419 it turns real and bloody. They take over Prague, and they're fighting with the royalists and the Catholic crusaders, and they've gone loopy. They've gone wacky. In 1418, Picardy, probably Beghards or Beguines, living in the area now called Belgium, migrated en masse to Prague. Now, this is the year before all of this is going on, after hearing of the revolutionary upheaval there. The Waldensians were already there. Soon, according to Gretz, the Jewish historian Gretz, Jews expelled from Austria for collaborating with the Hussites joined them. All of these groups contributed ideas to the revolution, which took on a life of its own during the winter of 1419-1420. Adventism was part of that life. In the story of the priests of Tabor, John Prebham, Prebram, names 26 Taborite priests who, quote, preached that Judgment Day would come in 1420. As more peasants streamed into the city, preachers upped the ante, until finally they named the day, proclaiming that the second coming would occur between February 10 and 14, 1420. citing Revelation 18:2, the radical preachers predicted the entire old order would perish. Their claims split the Hussite movement. The split widened when the world did not end on schedule. Jakubek of Strebro argued against the Adventists that, quote, even the worst calamities did not annul the sure path to salvation taught by Jesus, the path of virtuous and humble suffering, unquote. But the appeal of millennialism, Adventism, and the whole Judaizing tendency toward messianic politics on politics and heaven on earth through the sword lay precisely in its rejection of humble suffering. The Hussite conservatives found themselves swept up in a movement that was no longer Christian in any identifiable sense. Hussitism had become a Jewish revolutionary movement, says Jones. The revolution was a parasite inside the Hussite host. It infected the movement, then it weakened it, and then it took over the host and turned it into the vehicle for revolution. Jakubek realized the withdrawal from society happening all around him was not only unprecedented, but it was also profoundly subversive. Did you not formally preach against killing? Jakubek asked Master John of Gicin, J-I-C-I-N, and by extension all of Tabor's revolutionary priests. How then has everything come to be turned into its opposite? By the opposite, Jakubek was referring to revolutionary messianic politics preached by the Taborite priest, urging the use of, quote, carnal and secular arms against the enemy. This led to, quote, the danger of homicide and bloodshed, unquote, as, quote, hatreds are thereby generated which bring about a falling away from charity and a neglect of spiritual arms, unquote. Jakubek felt the priests of Tabor should persuade people to fight an evangelical battle in God's cause, according to the evangelical and Catholic sense, with spiritual arms in the model of the primitive Christian Church of Christ's apostles, unquote. Instead, the preaching and, quote, perilous interpretations of Scripture, unquote, of the Taborite priest were leading the people to take up, quote, carnal military arms, abandoning the customary labor of their hands, and living in idleness from the plundering of their neighbor's substance, and that they kill and shed blood. So, they're saying that the priests are leading the people astray. They're encouraging them to fight and kill and death and destruction and live by being pirates and marauders rather than living in their humble and suffering ways advised by Jesus and the true church. Nowhere was the change in Hussite revolution more drastic than in the area of carnal arms. Newman and others felt the Waldensian heretics had prepared the way for the Hussites, especially in southern Bohemia, where their influence had always been strong. But the Waldensians were pacifists. The revolution turned on the Waldensians by rejecting pacifism in favor of Israelite holy war. In summer 1420, Peter Chalcicky tried to explain the trajectory in On Spiritual Battle, a book, according to which the devil took over the Hussite movement during the winter of 1419-20 and turned it into a revolutionary movement based on Old Testament models. The devil, says Chalcicky, came to them clothed in other garb, in the prophets and the Old Testament, and from these they sought to confect an imminent day of judgment, saying that they were angels who had come to eliminate all scandals from Christ's kingdom, and that they were to judge the world. And so they committed many killings and impoverished many people, but they did not judge the world according to their works, for the predicted time has elapsed with which they terrified the people, telling them strange things which they collected from many prophets. At some point during the winter of 1419-1420, the congregations degenerated morally to the point where their reaction to persecution in the winter of 1419-1420 was not the Christian suffering of the New Testament, but the self-conscious violence of the Old. So, like Jews, they're fighting back, and unlike Christians, they're not giving in. Is that all bad? I don't know. Seems like not fighting back leads to just as bad a result as fighting back, if not worse. The assessment is Kaminsky's, but he is clearly following Chalcicky's lead. Chalcicky portrayed the conflict as between the old law and the new. If power were supposed to be administered through Christ's faith by means of battles and punishments, and try to benefit Christ's faith thereby, then why would Christ have abolished the Jewish law and established a different spiritual one? If he had wanted people to cut each other up, to hang, drown, and burn each other, and to otherwise pour out human blood for his law, then the old law could have stood unchanged, with the same bloody deeds as before. The turn toward revolution during that winter bespoke a reversion, says Jones, to the vomit of Judaism and a rejection of the cross, the symbol under which civilization had grown for a millennium in Europe. The uprooting of thousands of peasants by the preaching of the Judaizers increased the pressure to pursue the revolutionary course. Since the uprooted peasants were no longer tilling their fields, they had to pillage their non-Adventist, non-revolutionary neighbors to survive. They had to destroy to live. The revolutionary creed rationalized their violence and gave them incentive to pursue it to its bloody conclusion. Adventism, the idea that the current order was going to be destroyed, flowed inexorably from the premises of millennialism. As we have seen from Adventism, it was only a short step to messianic politics, which decreed that the new heaven and new earth could be brought about by the sword. Theological doctrines ratify the revolutionary situation. When the peasants left their farms and moved to Tabor, they had to pillage and destroy in order to survive. That is how the revolutionary engine got created. And I think we'll leave it there for now. We've been going about 3.5 hours, and my voice is getting a little worn down here. But this, basically what we did today was give you the history of the opening part of the Hussite Revolution, which Jones is saying is the first revolution of modern times. And we're going to go all the way through the Hussite Revolution, and we're going to go through all the rest of the revolutions, which we've talked about on different shows, but we'll give you all of Jones's take on everything that happened pretty much from this period in 1419, 1420, all the way up to 2008. And give you a true history and grounding in Europe and the interrelations of the whites and the Jews and the Christians of various stripes, the Protestants and the Catholics. And we'll see all, we'll be able to make the parallels that Jones won't make or can't make because he believes in certain things that are antithetical to the white nationalist creed. But this is a good example of how crazed people can become in very short order from their readings of the Christian Bible. And I think it's good to get some true history out there. And earlier today we also covered the tragic case of the man shooting the niggers to protect his white family, and the legal battle that's going to ensue, the court mess that's going to ensue from that, and use that to advise you to stay away from niggers. They bring you nothing good. Before that, we finished our discussion of Marcus Garvey and black nationalism as undermined by the Jews, bent on using the Negro race to integrate, i.e. destroy, the white race in America in the 20th century. And I'm Alex Linder, this is Radio Estina, and we're going to leave it there for August 26th, 2008. This is Radio Estina number 22. All of our shows are archived at vnnforum.com, which we encourage you, the intelligent and self-controlled white man or woman, to join. All the shows are archived there. You can listen to the MP3s of this show and the 21 that preceded it, as well as the archives of our other radio shows, including Goyfire, our original panel discussion show, unlike this show, which is a one-man monologue presentation, lecture-type show, with a little bit of humor and some voices where we find it appropriate. But we do close readings of important texts on this show, generally combined with discussion of items pertinent to the future of the white race on terra firma. We'll leave it there. We'll pick it up more next time. We'll have new news items, and we'll have further discussion of the Hussite Revolution in Bohemia. And this show is always broadcast on Tuesday beginning at 1 p.m. Go to vnnforum.com to find it, or go to govnn.com, vanguardnewsnetwork.com, and it should be archived within the next have the MP3 archive up within the next 24 hours. I want to thank you for listening once again. My name is Alex Linder, this is Radio Estina, and I will now play songs until at least the top of the hour, and then I will cut the broadcast. So once again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
together.